It's showtime.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Even as we speak, I am unwrapping the emergency cherry Tootsie Pop and putting it here within easy reach as we go for another smoke-free broadcast. The ongoing saga of my attempt to not be a smoker anymore. Hey, Darlene. Darlene and Jason. Otherwise known as Bikini Man, are in the live video audience. Hey, y'all. This is the Horn. Headon.live is where you'll find us every Monday through Friday, except like last night. From 5 to 8 Eastern Time, 2 to 5 Pacific Time. Hi, I'm Bob. It's Boxing Day. Will in Chicago lets me know, as far as I know, Bob, you're the only live national progressive host today. Well, I'm, tell your friends and neighbors. By all means, thank you for letting me know, Will. Maybe we could grow the community a little bit that way. And the more the merrier as far as the conversation is concerned. It is, like I said, Boxing Day, the 26th day of December. That means it is the 24th trip around the sun for my son, Ferg, our son, Agnes, and me. And I hope he's having a good birthday back home in the hills and hollers of Almost Level West by Cold Trump, Virginia, Stan. I think he went out for a birthday lunch earlier today. And, of course, every program here at the Horn begins with gratitude. This day is no different. We have thanks to send out both for today and for yesterday, the 25th of the month. Our 25th of the month subscribers, thanks very kindly to James in Spain, to Kay. Thank you to Mark, and thank you to our fundraising goal for today was $100 because we actually knocked out half of it thanks to your determination on Tuesday. And then Charlene in Rogues Island, a founding member of the sorority of Leans, and as well as a founding member of Queen Tracy's Reverse Oreo Society, Charlene wiped out today. So there's no actual fundraising goal for today. And that means that to end December 2019, we're $600 away. So we could conceivably get started on knocking that out this evening. And that would be wonderful. And thanks to our 26th day of the month subscribers. Thank you to Michael and Madison. Thank you to Peter. And thank you to Milton, who shares a birthday with Ferg. Happy birthday, Milton, and many happy returns. Thanks for being, all of you, thank you for being partial sponsors of the program. And thank you very kindly and most happy birthday to Milton. Thanks very much indeed. So here it is, the day after Christmas, and And I hope you all had a lovely holiday, whether you, however you may have celebrated it, whether it was part of Hanukkah or Christmas itself, or whatever religion, faith, tradition, et cetera. I hope you had a lovely day. I did. It was up in the 70s, and we had some early sunshine. It got cloudy later. But I got to, you don't need the detail, and certainly not going to make we're not going to do an instant replay on the video. But suffice to say, I got down to shorts and a t-shirt yesterday afternoon. It was nice. And watched an absolutely magnificent sunset here in northwest Alabama. And trying to sort of figuring how the orientation of the earth is relative to the sun, I drew a straight line, and I think the sunset I was looking at disappeared somewhere in the Pacific off of the tip of the Baja Peninsula. It's nice to think about things like that. Now, as far as Christmas Eve was concerned, I did follow through. I had mentioned that I might do something for an evening service, and I did. I went ahead and got my suit and tie on and it was between the Roman Catholics and the Episcopalians, because the Baptists had had their service while we were together in conversation. Those deacons, they like to get home early and get into the wassail in the privacy of their own homes where no one can see what they're up to. And I guess it was the same with the Church of Christers and whatever. So it was down to Catholics or Episcopalians. And I decided to go Episcopalian. They're mellower. And among other things, for a misogynistic religion like Christianity, they at least push back a little bit. They ordain women, for instance. And setting aside the irony of ordaining women in a religion that is essentially misogynistic, it's still a step toward equality. And they also are supportive of the LGBTQ community. And they made a point of saying in their program that all are welcome without question. And so I gave them the chance. And then there was another thing. Back in 1680, a man named Abraham Goad, according to church records, brought a pound of tobacco. I think I've told this story before. He brought a pound of tobacco that he had raised by the sweat of his own brow. His daddy had landed first in Roxbury, Massachusetts, and somehow or another he found his way down to Virginia, and he farmed. And he brought the records indicate that he brought a pound of tobacco to his local Anglican church and gave it to the church in gratitude to God for the birth of a healthy son. And his father and he himself and his son, for whom he brought the pound of tobacco, were all my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfathers. So there's that. I sort of meditated on it, about how instead of having the use or sale, whatever, of that tobacco to support his newborn son, he instead supported some priest. But religion does that to you. They did a passing fair job. It was pretty. Lots of poinsettias all over the place. Lots of candles lighted in windows. The stained glass windows along the sides were lighted beautifully. The window back of the altar was dark. They didn't have it illuminated. And so you couldn't make out exactly who it was, but I swear, looking at it, you could have sworn it was Batman, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't. The singing was pretty. While they were singing, "O Come All Ye Faithful" in English, I was singing it in Latin. But it was interesting from an anthropological standpoint. I didn't feel particularly spiritually uplifted. I got a lot more uplift the next morning when I was invited to be among friends for a Christmas lunch. But it was a pleasant and quiet day. And I finished it with, and a lot of you have seen the photo on social media. I finished it with my own version of white wine in the sun, thinking of my family back in West Virginia, down on the Gulf Coast, out in New Mexico, and others who are no longer here. Christmas is a reflective time as well. But as the punchline to the old joke goes, coffee breaks over back on your heads, because that's how it goes in the penultimate year of the second decade of the 21st century. And I've seen a couple of references in articles to this being the final year of the second decade. No, it's the next to last year. When we count, we don't say 0, 1, 2. So the second decade of the 21st century will end on December 31st, 2020. Exactly, Flavio. Adeste fidelis. Laeti triumphanti. Venite, venite, in Bethlehem, etc., etc., etc. Only that I left out the etc. part. No mention in the church service of children in cages in concentration camps. I guess the social conscience is too much to expect of a Christmas Eve midnight ceremony, regardless of the distinct similarity to the myth of the birth of Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and semi-literate itinerant rabbi who wore a dress every day of his life. Nope. Not at all. I sat in the pews and I reflected on the fact that it was founded in 1824. The building it's in now was built in 1894, 70 years after it had been in existence. And it's just down the street from a place where between 1820 and 1830, you want to talk about history, between 1820 and 1830, there had been an inn there. And it's, of course, there's not even a hint of it anymore except for a historical marker. But it had been the Peter Blow Inn, B-L-O-W. And Peter Blow and his family had come from Virginia down to the wild frontier west, which is what Alabama once was. And they stopped first in Huntsville, but then they came 72 miles on west because I guess that's where all the action was and that's where the opportunity was. And there in 1820, they founded something called he founded something called the Peter Blow Inn. And it was exactly that. It was an inn for travelers. There were a lot of people passing through there back then. It was a busy frontier. America's first travel writer, Anne Royal, America's first blogger, Anne Royal, written so brilliantly about by my good friend Jeff Biggers in his book, his analysis of her life, The Trials of a Scold. She wrote about the wild and depraved conditions in North Alabama early in her travel writings. But at the Peter Blow Inn, of course, it was the wild frontier, and it was the wild frontier plus slavery. And if you ran an inn back then, you had to have someone to take care of your horses and take care of the horses of the guests and perhaps the carriage crews. And Peter Blow had a hostler. That's what you call the person who takes care of the horses, a hostler, H-O-S-T-L-E-R. And they ran the inn, I suppose, fairly successfully for 10 years, and then they moved on to Missouri. Well, the hostler at that time was a young-ish African-American slave. And when they left Alabama, they took him with him to Missouri. They sold him to a Dr. Emerson. And when he got into free territory, he sued, claiming that he should be free because he was in a free state. Talk about hinges of history. That man's name, although the Supreme Court would not recognize that he was a man and in fact said that he was nothing but property, that man's name was Dred Scott. And now you know the rest of the story. How about that, though? I mean, that kind of history's all over here. And so that church I was sitting in as I sat there Christmas Eve, I wondered how many hundreds, because I'm sure it got a lot more it got a lot more participation way back when than it does now. I wondered how many Christians had sat in those pews in its previous location. How many Christians had sat in its pews and listened to lessons out of the Bible and then gone home to a house full of enslaved human beings and still considered themselves Christians? Short answer, all of them, up until 1865. All of them. That's the thing. If you know history, if you think about history, it's like being in fast-moving water. You can never, I guess after a while, some people get used to being in the water, you know, your big-time Olympic swimmers and whatnot. Maybe they feel more comfortable in water than out of it. But with the exception of them, you tend to constantly think about the water. And if you're as tuned into history as I am, you can't stop thinking about the who's and the what's and the when's and the where's of everything that has come before, wherever it is you happen to be, or wherever it is, in my case, I happen to be. And I just couldn't make it square. I couldn't sort out how it is that people could delude themselves into thinking that they were Christians at the same time that they were being driven to and from church in buggies that were driven by people they thought that they owned. But that's me applying a modern sense to a decidedly unmodern time. So that was Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. Like I said, I hope you had a pleasant day. Lee in New York with our obligatory Star Trek reference to begin the Boxing Day broadcast. Star Trek connected people who celebrated birthdays on this day of the year. Carl W. Daniels, production sound mixer. Elisha Cook Jr., actor. Samuel T. Cogley in the episode Court Martial. He was born 1903. Bernard Cates, born 1922, actor. He was Sigmund Freud in the Star Trek Next Generation episode Phantasms. Chuck Hicks, 1927, a stuntman. Christina Kokoff, 1964, production associate. Guy Vardman, 1964, stand-in performer. And Christopher Doyle, year unknown, stuntman, stunt actor, stunt coordinator, and director. Wow. It's a big day. Thanks, Lee. Thank you very kindly to Ralphs for her happy birthday wish for Ferg. Steve in New York, not in New York, in Ottawa. A very happy Boxing Day from the capital of Canada, Ottawa. And I got a Canada story to go with it. How was my Christmas? Scott in San Diego asks. Fine, he answers. Except Santa didn't bring me what I really wanted most. Trump gone, sigh. Yeah, we may have to wait for that. That may be our Christmas gift for Christmas 2020, the final year of the second decade of the 21st century. So Dave in Talibandiana says, I had a pleasant Christmas, but no white wine. My dad and I both hate each other, probably because my sister kept the knives away from me as I was sitting next to, and I asked her why she did this. Was it because she didn't want me to have what I really wanted for Christmas, to be an orphan? I chuckled. No politics was brought up. We played euchre into the wee hours of the night. I also listened to White Wine in the Sun a few times and began the weep. I wept healing tears, Bob. It was a good choice. Thank you for sharing it. Your buddy Dave, back home in the blind. I have never played euchre. I should probably learn. Just one of those things you don't want to leave undone. And I mentioned the Canada angle just for our Canadian friends. Lauren is who is ordinarily from the far frozen north up around Edmonton way. I made a mistake the other night, not Calgary, Edmonton. And she is taking refuge in Washington State at the moment. But we have lots of friends up in far Canada. And I guess as part of the holiday tradition, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the CBC, airs Home Alone 2 nationwide, just like Hockey Night in Canada. And this year, somebody noticed that, no, the Donald Trump scene had been cut From Home Alone 2. And, you know, Far Canada has its maggots. Only in far frozen Canada, we don't say they don't have sense enough to come in out of the rain. We say they don't have sense enough to come in out of the snow. But we do. We also adapt and say that your Canadian maggot types don't have sense enough to pour snow out of a boot with directions on the heel. Yeah. But the CBC did that. They cut the Donald Trump scene right out of Home Alone 2. Because Canada doesn't want to be great. And some Canadians noticed. And some Americans noticed. That neo-maxi zoom dweeby Andy Ngo, who tried to pogo stick up onto the cross after he claimed that he was hit by a concrete milkshake by the anti-fascists when he was out there trying to egg the anti-fascists on. Because he was participating with the right-wing neo-Nazi, neo-nationalist filth in one of their brutal riots. Andy Ngo said, the Donald Trump cameo was censored in the CBC airing of Home Alone 2. It was censored. Do you hear? Censored. God almighty, it was censored. And this got the weirdos rolling. Another American, the maggot sleazoid named Jack Prisobiec said, CBC deletes Trump scene from Home Alone 2 broadcast. A Canadian maggot said, cuck level ninja. Yeah. Yeah, Paul Joseph Watson, Canadian state-funded broadcaster CBC, deleted the scene featuring Donald Trump from their Christmas broadcast of Home Alone 2. There's only one problem. They deleted it back in 2013 or 2014, and the weirdos are just getting around to noticing. You know, because maggots, otne ute I pray if you one what I eat may. But instead, it was a nefarious plot to somehow offend Donald Trump because deep state, Bruga, Bruga, Bruga. Mm-hmm. Well, at least Canadians are polite about it. One Canadian said, defund CBC now. The CBC is paid for by Canadian tax dollars, yet they continually get away with this politically charged bias, eh? I added the A. Canada, this is what our tax dollars supports, eh? Our state broadcaster, the CBC, eh? Removed one of the most iconic parts, Home Alone, because they can't handle Trump, eh? Steve in New York reminding us, and once again, we're the snowflakes, right? Well, but I'm grateful for the fact that the Canadian maggots protested politely. If that had happened in down here in the new 90 states of Merca, maggots would still be out shooting their televisions. Because you know they do that. The folks that make those incredibly expensive, those Yeti makes those incredibly expensive coolers and reusable thermos jugs and whatnot. I mean, you can drop $800 on an ice chest. And it's just that, an ice chest. It's not encrusted in, it's not zircon encrusted, or it doesn't plug up, or it's just an ice chest. And you can drop $800 on one. At least five. And back when Yeti said it didn't want anything to do with the National Ruble Association anymore, good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, ammosexual maggots went out and, having already spent a small fortune on a cooler, took out their Second Amendment freedom protectors and proceeded to blow them coolers to kingdom come. Just like back when Nike said that they were going to make Colin Kaepernick a spokesman, the maggots, using their maggot brains, took the Nike tennis shoes that they, sneakers, basketball shoes, whatever, generic. They took their Nikes out and their Nike apparel and whatnot that they had already paid for and burned them and shot them and blew them up because, well, maggots. Yeah. But I just feel so, I feel so damn bad for all those Canoodlians who got their Christmas runt because they did not get to gaze on the cameo appearance of Donald J. Trump, the J stands for Jesus, in Home Alone 2, Lost in New York. Because, I mean, fuck, It's a Wonderful Life. It hasn't been Christmas if you haven't gazed on the considerably younger version of Donald J. Trump, the J stands for genius, in Home Alone 2, Lost in New York. Of course not. Ugh. Can you imagine being that weird, that uninformed, that incurious, that itching to be insulted? Oh, and by the way, the CBC cut it out years ago, and the reason they cut it out was a reason that the maximum mother of all businessmen Donald Trump would have to agree with, because they cut the scene out to create more time to insert what? Yes, commercials to make what? Yes, money. Yeah, isn't it, how fast, yeah, how capitalist of them. Maggots. Can't live with them. Can't shoot them to the moon. Oh, another thing that's happened in the last 24 hours or so. Lisa Murkowski, senator from Alaska, has declared that she's not comfortable. She's not comfortable with the and she said this on Tuesday, Christmas Eve, in an interview with something, I think it was KTUU TV in Alaska. Maybe, I don't know, I may have the call sign wrong, but anyway, in a TV interview, she said, in fairness, when I heard that, namely that Moscow Mitch McConnell was going to rig the impeachment trial so that it wouldn't be a trial at all anymore and would instead be, a cover-up, the Senate cover-up. When she heard about that, Murkowski said, to me, it means that we have to take that step back from being hand in glove with the defense. And so I heard what Leader McConnell had said. I happen to think that has further confused the process. And so there has, in the last 48 hours, been a massive degree of Sturm und Drang with people saying, oh my goodness, do you think noted Alaskan moderate Lisa Murkowski might possibly join with the Democrats and buck Mitch McConnell? And I just sit back and seven up. No. This is the usual smoke and mirrors. This is the usual carnival barker's pitch outside of the next to the sign that says this way to the egress. She will hem and haw. She will wring her hands, Lisa Murkowski, and she will clutch her pearls. And then Moscow Mitch will call her into his office, or maybe he'll just amble on by hers and say, Santa Lisa, I was shocked, I tell you. I was surprised. But more than anything, Senator Lisa, I was hurt when I heard you say that you might not do the right thing for the party. I was hurt, Lisa. I was. And, you know, I know that you depend on a lot of Senate votes and these Republican votes, Lisa, to get things you want for that godforsaken place that you represent. Shit, you represent more polar bears than I do people. And so I wouldn't, at least I wouldn't want anything to happen to the money that you need the federal government to send on up there to that frozen shithole you're from. I wouldn't want anything to happen at all. So Lisa, let's just forget about how you said that you were disturbed that I was going to work hand in glove with Donald Trump and cover this thing up and not have a trial like the Constitution says we're supposed to. Let's just forget you said anything about it, because I'd hate for something to happen to all that money you want for that frozen hellscape. I'd hate that. Wouldn't you hate that, Lisa? Now, don't you worry. The multimillionaire for-profit media will continue to call you a moderate, just like they do with Susan Collins. Yeah, but it's all right. You just be as moderate as you need to be, honey. But when the time comes, you need to remember where just exactly where your igloo is buttered. And you just vote right along with old Lita Mitch, and everything will be just fine. I mean, you do want to drill the living bejesus out of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge now, don't you, Lisa? And y'all got, I do declare, y'all have some stands of damn near virgin temperate rainforest timber up there. Wouldn't you like to let some of those folks that write you the big checks, wouldn't you like to let them go in with their chainsaws and just cut the shit out of it, Lisa? Well, see, if you keep talking about how you're disturbed, that might not be able to happen, Lisa. So you just go on and you do what you need to do. And if you want them to call you a moderate, that's fine by me. Talk to Susie from Maine up there. She knows how to do it. She's got the for-profit media out there calling her moderate all the time. And she always does what she's told. That's what I want from little women like you, Lisa. I want you to do what you're told. Do what it says in the Bible. If you got any questions, ask a man about it. And let a man like me, Mitch McConnell, tell you what's right to do, little lady. Oh, but the simpletons and the in the for-profit media, they ate it up with two spoons. And they were all a titter over the last 48 hours. Do you think noted moderate Lisa Murkowski can get maybe noted moderate Susan Collins and noted moderate Bishop Willard Romney and noted moderate Cory Gardner of Colorado, can they buck Mitch McConnell? Not if they want to go on being senators, they can't. Yeah. But you won't hear anybody pointing that out over in the multimillionaire for-profit media, because they don't take it kindly when somebody looks into the camera and says, "What kind of suckers are y'all?" Let me guess. Right before you came to work, you were out by that subway entrance playing three card Monte, thinking if you just dealt one more hand, well, by God, you'd finally win, because it can't be that hard to find that queen. Jesus. Nitwit Nero, meanwhile, is still trying to learn exactly how this whole impeachment thingamajig works. He spent his Christmas holiday, instead of enjoying it or anything like that, he spent it, what? Of course, tweeting. Tweeting about how he didn't understand how it come to be that he was impeached.
Why should crazy Nancy Pelosi, just because she has a slight majority in the House, be allowed to impeach the President of the United States? Got zero Republican votes, for there was no crime. The call with Ukraine was perfect, with no pressure.
He put "no pressure" in apostrophe quotes. No kidding. He did. And oddly enough, there's nothing in the Constitution about having a slight majority. I mean, you want to talk about slight majorities. That's what Moscow Mitch has. That's true. Maybe she'll follow through. It's possible. I could be wrong about this. Brother Deacon Asa pointing out Lisa Murkowski has one thing going for her. She did vote against Justice Beerbong. So, yeah, there's that. What's that, Flavio? Flavio says, she sounds like Christine Blasey Ford. I never knew what she sounded like, but don't be fooled. And with every passing day, remember, the heat ramps up a little bit more on Chlamydia Claudius. And Moscow Mitch. Dig it. Over at the Louisville Courier-Journal, liberal media. I think they're owned by Gannett, not exactly known for its liberality. But over at the Louisville Courier-Journal, they published an op-ed by a law professor from Boston College. Well, what do we care about him? Well, he's a Kentuckian, a fellow by the name of Kent Greenfield. And he said in no uncertain terms that if Moscow Mitch goes forward with the plan that he has announced, that he will be taking a big steamer right on top of the Constitution of the United States. He wrote, "The framers wanted to make sure the Senate would never take such a trial lightly. This oath requirement is over and above the oath each senator has already taken to support the Constitution. The Constitution does not set out the text of the trial oath, but the Senate rules do. Senators will solemnly swear that in all things appertaining to the trial of the impeachment of Donald J. Trump, now pending, I will do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws. So help me God. Sounds like that's completely at odds with what Moscow Mitch has planned, doesn't it? And they say he doesn't like being called Moscow Mitch. But if that's the case, then maybe it would serve him well to stop behaving like one of Moscow's at least useful idiots. Kent Greenfield wrapped up his op-ed in the Louisville Courier-Journal saying, short of declaring war, the Senate is about to conduct its gravest and most serious constitutional obligation to exercise the sole power to try impeachments. Sole power to try is a quote from the Constitution. And it sort of answers the tweet from Nitwit Nero asking, why with a slim majority can Nancy Pelosi impeach me? Well, the answer to that question is because the House shall have the sole power to impeach. Kent Greenfield says, all senators should take their obligation of faithful impartiality seriously, especially McConnell. History is watching, and it will be a harsh judge. A harsh judge. I agree. But history's judged a lot of Congress's acts. And you don't see anybody wringing their hands over it now, do you? Lee in New York, as regard to Lisa Murkowski, says, I remember when she had to be a write-in candidate to get elected, and yet she will vote with them. There are no northern lights between her and the maggots in the Senate. Her words say one thing, her votes say another. Now, on the other hand, we do have to acknowledge the mathematical reality of what would happen if she, Bishop Willard, Susan Collins, and Cory Gardner all decided to object to Mitch's plan to have a Senate cover-up that doesn't involve calling any witnesses. That would mean that it's not a tie. That would mean that Moscow Mitch slap did not have the votes to do what he wanted to do. To wit, a cover-up. And that changes the calculus considerably. Because venereal Vespasian still does, in his heart of hearts, he wants a media circus. He wants a circus, plain old-fashioned, in the Senate. He doesn't realize that in the trial of Bill Clinton, there wasn't a whole lot of opportunities for media excitement. Recall that they did take witness testimony in the Clinton impeachment trial. But here's the rub. They did not have any live witnesses. It was all done by video deposition. And so the senators sat there, you know, drowsing a little bit. And you don't mean for your eyes to close. What? And that's what the senators did. while the video witness testimony was playing. So the likelihood, I would guess, even if Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins, Bishop Willard, and Corey Gardner all defect, the likelihood of live witnesses, whether it be Mick Mulvaney or John Pornstash Bolton or Hunter Biden or anybody showing up there and testifying behind closed doors or open doors approaches absolute mathematical zero. But nothing's going to happen until after the new year, one way or the other. Subject line, far left news, Lee in New York. Stop it, Bob. That's for the homage to Stop It, Spock. For Trump supporters, if you are to the left of the One America News Network, you know, ONAN, the news network that spills its news upon the ground, you're either left-wing propaganda like Fox or far left like everyone else. Because only the most special of maggots are right-wing enough. Yeah. Had a note from Paul from Parts Unknown. He has mailed off the Paulmans. I'm still waiting on an address for one of you, but they should arrive in about 3 days for perfectly timed for New Year's Eve snacking. Oh, and a little program note here about the top of the hour or so, if all things go as planned. I'll be having a conversation with our good friend, Dan Fisher. He's on a break from work until, I think, the 6th of January. And so he had a little time. He's had, he and Helene have had the kids in. And that's a lovely thing when they're grown and so Gus and Phoebe have been in, and they've spent many happy hours watching Christmas movies and playing Uno and things like that. And he and I are going to get together, we're in about 8 minutes or so, for a conversation about, well, looking back at the whole bloomin' blessed year. Should be fun. My conversations with Dan always are. Stephen Ottawa with an observation. Why with a slim majority? You know that reference from Nitwit Nero's Twoop. Steve observes, if any other president had ever asked that, the clang of incompetence and laughter at that president would be deafening. Here I go, saying and observing nothing new, but I need to say it as a catharsis. I understand. Perhaps more than you know. Oh, and one other thing about Moscow Mitch. There was an announcement recently that miners' pensions, coal miners' pensions, had been saved. And so there was much rejoicing. Yay! But over at DC Report at Raw Story, Maureen Nevin Duffy has the explainer on how, in the process of saving those miners, you, dear taxpayer, got squooed. Squooed, booed, and tattooed. You may recall that last week we got a temporary spending bill through of some $1.4 trillion. And included in that package was $15 billion to the tune of $500 million a year for 30 years to keep the Black Lung Disability Trust Fund afloat. Black lung is a scourge and a shame upon our nation. It's the price that we pay for our foolhardy obsession with continuing to burn coal. Somewhere around one out of every five coal miners suffers from black lung. If you work in coal, you will eventually have coal dust in your lungs. And it would have been an act of true brutality to leave them flapping in the breeze. But here's where it gets funny. No, it doesn't. Here's where it gets infuriating. Yeah, that part was in the package. But Moscow Mitch took out of the proposal the part that would have made coal companies pay more toward the health care of those who they employ and those who are retired from their employment. He also nixed a wee tiny increase of the tax on coal mining that supports the trust fund, because when the Black Lung Fund was first envisioned, everybody understood it was not the business of we, the people of the United States, to take care of the miners, but that in fact it was the business of the coal companies who had done it to the miners in the first place. Well, that's all over now. Yep. Because you, we, me, us, just got handed the tax bill for keeping the Black Lung Fund among the quick. How's that feel? I mean, look, I'm more radical than maybe I let on. And so I believe in things like taking care of the health care needs of every last American. The minute you're born, you got health care coverage. The minute you die, it ends. Not really. Maybe we need to make sure you get properly buried, too. And not in the deep bosom of the ocean buried, either. I believe in that. I support it. I think it is fundamentally American, and it is fundamentally a part of the most essential mission of the Constitution as it is enumerated in the preamble. Not so much the maggots and Republicans. It was originally part of a tonnage rate that was imposed on the coal company. You want to mine this stuff? You want to make money doing it? You want to kill people while you're making money do it? You pay for it. Because that's how we do it in a for-profit healthcare system. We don't ask some poor, beaten, and bedraggled health insurance company to pay for something that the coal company caused. Well, looks like we're going to have some socialized medicine for coal miners, because you're going to be on the hook for it. And guess who gets to laugh all the way to the bank? Yes, of course, absolutely. The coal companies. The coal companies. And black lung is a horrible way to die. I know it for a fact. And Mitch McConnell has been as deaf as a graven image to the needs of people in eastern Kentucky. And so the 2020 tax rate on coal companies will revert to 2018 rates, $1.10 and 55 cents per ton. And then those rates sunset December 31st, 2020. And if the Congress has, this is hilarious. If the Congress has not acted by then, the tax will revert to the 1978 rate when I was 15 years old. And that's 50 cents and 25 cents per ton. And by law, the tax can never rise to more than 4.4% of the coal selling price. So Moscow Mitch is taking money from a Russian oligarch to build a dodgy, sketchy aluminum plant in Kentucky. But when it comes to the coal industry, he wants that to come out of your ass, America. Now, I see one of, because it is not right that we pay, that we give welfare to the coal companies. I mean, that just, look at them. It's coal. They've become permanently dependent upon corporate welfare. We either need to get it out of the, take it out of the hide of the coal companies, or damned well enact Medicare for all. And take care of all Americans, not just coal miners. Because one of the things we need to bear in mind is that a lot more people die from coal-related illness than just coal miners. A whole lot more. And we can go into some more of that in relatively short order. In the meantime, I'm waiting to hear from our buddy Dan. Check in here. We'll see. Meanwhile, Flavio with an observation. Moscow Mitch. Oh, by the way, James and Ed and Andy all joined in the video over on Facebook. Good to see y'all. Thanks for being here. Especially Ed. Hey, Ed. Ed and I go way back. Flavio noting, Moscow Mitch and Elaine Chao have to be the evilest crime couple in modern memory. Yeah, they're the Joker and Harlequin, aren't they? Harley Quinn. The Joker and Harley Quinn. You got the Russian mafia and the Chinese mafia combined in those two. And maybe even the hillbilly mafia. You know the difference between the Russian mob and the hillbilly mob, right? The Russian mob makes you an offer you can't refuse, and the hillbilly mob makes you an offer you can't understand. That, of course, is stolen from Blazing Saddles, but it seemed appropriate at the time. Let me check in here. Dan's usually really, really prompt. Man, he's been busy. Been working a lot lately. Well, I pissed off the boss. You're not a member of the hillbilly mob, Agnes. Agnes says, screw you, Bob. Wish you were here, dear. Screw you, Bob. I'm a hillbilly, and I think you understand me well enough. But you're not a member of the hillbilly mob, dear. Wish you were here. Okay, so I'm waiting to hear back from Dan. I'm going to take a moment here and go to the logo on the video. Don't go away. Program still going on. Stand by. This is the horn. It's just like the old mouthful of food at a restaurant rule. You get a mouthful of food, and the server immediately comes up and says, "Everything all right with y'all?" Well, the same is true. I'm happy to announce that my buddy Dan Fisher is with us now. I stepped away from the microphone for a moment, and there went Skype.
What did you do? Did you play Stairway to Heaven while you went to take a pee?
No, I didn't play anything at all. I just on the video, I just put up the horn logo, and I went dark on the audio. Because if I play Stairway to Heaven, it screws up the replay over at Spotify and YouTube and what have you, because, you know, copyright.
And the next thing you know, the internet police are at your door. They're banging it down. they're dragging you off to internet jail, and meanwhile, if you're the president, you can tweet anything you want.
Precisely. And you can play all kinds of music that none of the artists want you to play.
This is true. This
at
is
your
true.
Damn rally.
Anyway, I'm calling to wish you and yours a happy holiday in observance of your particular faith, or if you don't care to observe or celebrate, well, that's perfectly okay, too.
And you know what? There are those...
Ho,
of
a, ho, ho.
Yeah, ho,
from
ho,
from the bottom
ho.
Of my heart. Ho, ho, ho.
Yes, your healthy, happy heart.
That's true. From my, not purloined heart, my borrowed heart, although I'm not giving it back. Yes.
Yeah, you have... let's see. What's the legal term? You don't have fee simple ownership. You have ownership of a life estate.
That's one way of looking at it. Used, previously owned. What do they say? Gently worn,
mm-hmm.
Something like that. I like gently worn. This idea that we're going to give you somebody else's pants, but they didn't do anything rough with them. You know, they just sat around and read poetry and drank tea while wearing these pants.
Yeah,
they didn't
right,
go
exactly.
out and fix
they-
cars or.
Yeah, they sat around reading Keats and you know, Plato.
Right. I mean, I have no guarantee that the donor of my heart didn't have his broken a couple of times by somebody or other. I don't know anything about that person. But, of course, I thank that person silently every day.
And things are going well?
Things are going well. Thank you for asking. Health-wise... my only thing is, you know, the holidays, I'm completely, you know, yesterday was a cheat day. I had far more sugar than I should have had. And most likely, you know, the buffet table had salt in everything, probably even the salad. And these were health conscious New York people, but salt's in everything. And it's the enemy. But what are you going to do? I mean, I got to live.
You're not a monk.
Yeah. I mean, I can't live too much that I don't live anymore. I got to live. You know, prudently, but I got to live just a little bit.
Yeah, that old Latin phrase.
The holiday standard.
Dum vivimus, vivamus. While we live, so let us live.
Ooh, Latin.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
like when Tish speaks French in the Addams Family. Oh, Bob, you spoke Latin.
I know. Wonderful, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I just woke up from a nap not too long ago, so right now my voice is down in Kincaid levels itself. We'll see if it gets up to proper Don Knotts levels of tonality.
You sound positively resonant.
Mm. That's right. And I'm going to announce that the Martians are attacking New Jersey.
Oh, you do that very well.
Yeah. Well, I tried to give Jersey instead of Jersey. I tried to remember that I am a theater major. There is a piece of paper somewhere that says that I'm a master. A bachelor. Of fine arts. I'm not a master. I'm an unmarried gentle person of fine arts. Fine arts, not anything less than fine.
Yes, I'm just a bachelor of plain old arts.
Well, we're just a couple of bachelors, lifelong bachelors, and if we were together, people would talk, wouldn't they?
Oh, they surely would. And let's start a revival of the Odd Couple.
You got me there. You know, we are odd.
You want to be Felix or Oscar? I've always felt more akin to Oscar, but I think I could go with the character stretch and play Felix.
Well, you know, I kind of live with a little bit of a Felix, so I think I could access. I think I could do some sense memory work on that and become something of a Felix. I mean, I'm neither of those people in my daily habits. I'm a bit of both, but. You know, the West Virginia in me doesn't want to wash his hands after using the bathroom. The New York in me wants to not only wash his hands but scour them in scalding water.
Disinfect the bathroom. Yes,
that's right. And all of my fingers in alphabetical order.
There's the rivalry down here between Alabama and Auburn. It's a big
yes, game. I do. Yeah. I do know of this.
Alabama and Auburn jokes proliferate, and there's there's one that is precisely on topic, in which an Alabama graduate and an Auburn graduate happen to be in the men's room at the same time, standing there at the bank of urinals. The Auburn graduate finishes first and goes over, and because they've got an engineering school that they're very proud of, and he very fastidiously washes and dries his hands, and the Alabama graduate just puts it away and zips up and goes sashaying out of the restroom. And the Auburn grad says, "Say, you know, down at Auburn, they taught us to always wash our hands after we go pee."
Mm-hmm.
And the Alabama graduate says, "Well, how about that? At Alabama, they taught us not pee on our hands."
Is that the joke? That's the punchline?
That's the joke.
Okay.
Tough crowd.
Well, plus being a transplant patient, I know that I have to wash my hands all the time, and that little tiny microbes and germs fly up onto your hands as you urinate all the time, especially in a urinal. So this is a message from the Hand Washers of America, folks. Always wash your hands. Don't be like that goofus, Alabama fellow. Be more of a gallant Auburner and wash your hands after using the bathroom, because you might meet a heart transplant patient along your way, and you might wish to shake hands with that person, and you don't want to give them germs. You don't want germs yourself. Folks, remember this, please. Wash your goddamn friggin' hands.
Yeah, and even though the sign in the restaurant says employees must wash hands before returning to work,
they won't wash yours. Don't.
Yeah, patrons.
They won't just wash random hands. They have to wash their own hands.
Yeah, patrons should consider themselves to be right at home and be employees too.
That's right. But don't be at home in the kitchen. They get paid to not well enough, but they do get paid to prepare your food and clean your dishes. So don't participate in that, please. Go sit in your chair and wait for them to bring you food.
And
this is a message from me.
I noticed something, speaking of which, I noticed something last night.
Yeah, you're always noticing things.
I'm a noticer.
Yeah.
An observer of the human condition, Dan.
Yes, the human condition. That's with capital letters, H and S.
Yes.
No, C, when, H and C, H and C.
When a cultural phenomenon reaches the far northwest corner of Alabama, you can pretty much guess that there is some sort of point of saturation being reached.
Mm-hmm.
This is northwest Alabama, and we do not say on a percentage basis have nearly as many Jewish folks here as, say, New York and its surrounding environs.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think that is a fair statistical presumption.
And one always hears about going out for Chinese on for Christmas dinner.
Oh, yes.
Well, lo and behold, I'm down here by myself. So I decided to go out for Chinese last night.
Uh-huh.
And every Chinese joint in this little community was doing a pretty solid business.
Uh-huh.
And then like I said, we have a synagogue here.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have
They're
two
everywhere.
We don't have two Jews. We don't have two synagogues. We got one.
One's enough. One can do the job.
But it's also not enough to carry the entire Chinese restaurant economy on Christmas night.
On Christmas night, yeah.
So the larger observation being that, us goyim, are picking up on how good it is to eat Chinese on Christmas too.
And here we get into the thorny issue of cultural appropriation. I can't say that the Jews invented the idea of eating Chinese food and then going to a movie on Christmas Eve. But they seem to have popularized it to the point where pretty much everybody can do that. You know, I'm sure.
Well, a lot of people seem to be doing it last night. And, you know, there's about a 1,000 year difference between the calculations between the Hebrew calendar and the Chinese calendar.
Mm-hmm.
The Jewish calendar has about 1,000 more years in it or so, a little over 1,000. So
I can't keep track.
So what that means is here in life on Earth, the Jewish people had to go 1,000 years without Chinese food. See, I got a better giggle out of you for that.
That's a good one. It's a little more literally close to home. I mean, I'm not Jewish. A lot of people think I am. Last name Fisher. I live in New York. Sometimes I talk fast. But no, I was raised in West Virginia, went to a Methodist church. I still know quite a bit of my Bible. I still remember quite a few of my hymns. But I do live in a house where technically I am the only non-Jew. My wife is Jewish, atheist Jew, but Jewish of culture. And my kids, because, you know, the mother is Jewish, they are considered Jewish to an extent. And so what we do, you know, this is, by the way, the fifth evening of Hanukkah. And we have our little Hanukkah tradition, which is we have a menorah. We properly put out the right amount of candles and light the candles. And after we've done this, we say happy Hanukkah to one another and we hug. And that's it. We're done. We don't do dreidels.
No dreidels.
Have latkes. No, no, no. Well, you know, the thing is, too, is it Hanukkah?
Well, you know,
I'm really dangling on the ledge here because I'm not Jewish and I'm going to talk about Jews as if I'm some sort of expert. God knows I'm not. But, you know, Hanukkah just isn't as sexy as Christmas. Christmas is the sexier holiday. And so, you know, when my wife grew up, they did get
Hanukkah's,
toys.
Hanukkah's kind of a stopgap.
You get, I mean, you do get presents for 8 nights in a row, but mostly they're like little things and, you know, chocolate in gold foil. And that's great. I mean, if you came up
I didn't realize
and offered me chocolate and gold foil, I'd probably take it.
But I heard the other day that in conjunction with the dreidel, they gamble with the geld.
That's true.
What are you teaching the children?
The children, Well, they don't gamble with the children. They don't place their kids down as wagers, as far as I know. I don't want that. You know, there's enough anti-Semitism in the world without spreading that one around. They don't use the children as chips.
Yep,
the dreidel wars.
And neither was I suggesting it.
Okay, I'm a little, I'm a liberal, so you know how us liberals are.
Yeah, I know.
Anything
like
can
Robert
set us
Frost
off.
Said, you won't
We're
even
so ta- sensitive.
You won't take
We're
your
so
own side in a fight.
Bob.
Yes. Will in Chicago, who is Jewish, says it is traditionally a minor holiday.
It is. I mean, my Jewish friends, will concede this point. But, you know, they did, somehow or other, they did seem to have come up with the idea of, hey, it's Christmas. This isn't really supposed to be our day. So let's go eat Chinese food. And, hey, by the way, let's catch the 9:40 of the last Skywalker movie thing.
Yeah, I got burned on The Last Jedi. I'm not going back. I'm done.
Yeah. To me, there's only 3 Star Wars movies, and they were made a long time ago in a galaxy far away.
In a movie studio far, far away.
Once Marcia Lucas divorced George Lucas, to me, the Star Wars movies stopped, because she really was the one that made them good. First of all, I don't know if you know this. I mean, she was one of the editors.
Oh, we're into my favorite part of the conversation. Go, man.
Yeah. Okay, so Marcia Lucas was married to George, like, back when he was just this schlubby film nerd and was trying to get his foothold in Hollywood. While his friends Francis Coppola and Spielberg were starting to do big things, George was just, George hit it with American Graffiti. But anyway, so Marcia Lucas was his wife. And she was a film student, too, and she was a brilliant editor. And so the first Star Wars movie, she was one of 3 editors. The last half hour of that movie, the one that everybody loves, of Luke going down into the canyon, blowing up the Death Star, come on home, kid, or whatever, Han Solo, that's all Marcia's work. She put that thing together. And so, and plus, what I think is that every night, when George, or every day when George was working at the script, he'd go, "Hey, Marcia, I've got this great idea. What if we do this character name? What if we have this character that talks about Misa Yusa do this, and he's got kind of dreadlocks?" And she's like, "No, George, that's a terrible idea. Leave that out of the Star Wars." And
yes.
Said, okay, honey. And he followed her advice, and he was there for 3. Well, the third wasn't as good because he got his way with the teddy bears. But he made 3 really very good Star Wars movies. But then, that's by that time they were divorced, and there was no one to say that's a terrible idea, George.
And so we get Jar Jar Binks.
Yeah, he was so successful. Everybody said, "Oh, whatever he said, that's a great idea, George.
You're a genius.
Wonderful. Let's do that movie." You know.
Oh, and speaking of which, you mentioned the Ewoks.
Yes.
And by the way, I did not know any of that. You mentioned the Ewoks. I'm an old science fiction nerd, and I read a lot of the classics when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make an argument that there is very little that is original in Star Wars.
Well, yeah. It wasn't, I don't think it was meant to be original. It was meant to be an homage.
And the minute that
go ahead,
one of the underappreciated greats of earlier science fiction was a writer named H. Beam, as in laser beam, Piper.
Wow, now you're educating me.
And he wrote a series, and it's exciting and charming and sort of has "make a movie out of me" written all over it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called Little Fuzzy.
Little Fuzzy?
Yeah. And it's about humans landing and beginning to exploit for its resources this world. And it has these little fuzzy creatures on them that are just adorable.
But do they have legs and arms?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. They're like little teddy bears that run around in the forest.
Oh, teddy bears in the forest. I see where you're going with this.
And
they're not tribbles. They're ambulatory.
They're anthropomorphic.
Yes.
And the great evil forces try to and the corporation that is exploiting the planet. Oh no, these aren't sentient beings. I learned the word sentient reading this as a child. They're not sentient. They're just animals. And H. Beam Piper himself was working in a sort of metatrope. And the next thing you know, there's a big conflict over whether or not, you know, and with the conflict being getting humans to acknowledge the rights of these fuzzies.
Okay. Now, this is what science fiction's about. It's not just about funny, goofy, adventurous things. It's about ideas.
And so by the time I saw the Ewoks, I was like, you thieving bastard.
Yeah. Because Kurosawa.
Kurosawa. Yeah. It should have sued.
Sure. Got a chunk of that. Yeah, but you know, all these guys, Spielberg and Coppola and Lucas, and then later on, even Spike Lee to an extent, and certainly a lot with Tarantino, you know, they went to film school, they paid whatever they paid per semester to sit there and watch a lot of old movies and learn them shot by shot, learn the vocabulary of film that way. But a lot of times the message is also, hey, pick and choose what works for you. And, you know, just give it a little spin and you can claim credit. It's sort of like, it's sort of like sampling in a way. It's sort of video sampling was done back in 1975 or 77. You know, let's take The Searchers and put it in space and, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, one of the things that makes me crazy is as a student of history, it always amazes me what parts of history Hollywood chooses to touch upon, or not even just Hollywood. We say that generically, but
right,
you know, video media.
And, right, there is no real Hollywood anymore. Yeah. I mean, it's a place, but there's not like one magical place where everything is made. It's spread out worldwide, and certainly among this nation. I live in one of those places, New York, in the New York City area. Certainly, as much, if not more, film production goes on here. Certainly television than in Los Angeles, for example. But yes,
there are stories,
the shining star ideal of what.
There are stories to be told out there that no one in film or TV. I've got a greater chance of winning the Powerball than they have of stumbling onto this piece of history.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that way with the entirety of it. I mean, some of them are even books. Like the little fuzzies that I just mentioned, they'll never stumble on.
Right.
On the other hand, to be kind of an asshole here, by all means, let's remake Little Women for the 15th time.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm hearing it's a lovely film, wonderful.
I'm sure it is.
But yeah. It's also the sixth or seventh remake.
This is true.
And to a certain extent, the same thing applies to 1917, about which I'm hearing good things.
Yeah, we'll probably get into it, but the list of movies that are in theaters that I have not seen is vast and stupefying.
Because why bother?
A lot of people, I don't go to movies much anymore. Even you know, during Oscar season, it still takes a lot to get me out there. I've just gotten used to not going out there. There's so much I don't need to, you know.
I live in America. I'm afraid to go to the movies. I might get shot. I'm not being funny.
Salty popcorn, but.
But 1917 kind of jumped out and grabbed me because I'm old enough that I go, damn, did whatever millennial make this never see Saving Private Ryan?
Right.
Because it's the same premise. It somebody greenlighted the almost identical same premise to Saving Private Ryan. And let it, but it's about World War One, not two. Oh, okay.
Well, I haven't seen it yet, so I should only comment so far.
It's a young man who has to go find a guy so that the guy won't die in the war.
But it's also done in super long takes, like through both camera work and through digital editing. It looks like, you know, a series of extremely long linking shots, you know, that go on and on for like 10-15 minutes.
Like that first shot in A Touch of Evil.
Exactly. Only that was done the old-fashioned way with camera work and, with a lot of logistics planned. And I know, again, I haven't seen 1917. I don't want to shit all over something I haven't seen.
No, I'm not shitting on it.
It's a little easier now than it used to be. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. I'm just surprised that... And I guess it's generational, Dan. If a generation's passed by, let's make it again and tell them it's all brand new.
Yeah, yeah. And listen, they did this back. You know, they did this back in the old days. You know, the Maltese Falcon was actually made twice before the version that the Bogart that John Huston made with Humphrey Bogart. That's the classic. There were two failed attempts at it within something like 12 to 15 years. So in a way, it makes, you know, Little Women look like, you know, a startling original prospect.
And the same thing with the Ten Commandments.
Done in the silent era. Ten Commandments had been done, Ben-Hur. You know, all these things had been done in previous times. So the idea of reboots isn't just in the corporate boardrooms of post-millennial, you know, Hollywood. It's been done for a while. But the percentage of movies that are reboots and sequels and superhero and all that stuff, it's far higher than it used to be. And that's something that turns, you know, my cranky old skull into mush. You know, I want originality. I say I do. And I actually I need to support that concept more. You know, my daughter just came back 2 days. Well, no, she 2 days ago, I should say, she saw Knives Out. And she loved it. You know, she's 20 years old.
I looked at the synopsis of that. I thought I should see it. Yeah.
Because I want an original. I keep saying I want original movies. There you go. That's an original screenplay. You know, yeah, I'm sure they borrowed all kinds of stuff from, you know,
but you know that going in. You know that going in. And it's part of the fun. It's, you know, it's an Easter egg hunt.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in a way, it's a descendant of a movie that came out when you and I were in college called Clue. The movie.
Right.
And I told Phoebe this. I said, you know, when I was in college, they did a, because she said a remark like, oh, it kind of felt in a way like a board game, Knives Out. And I said, it's funny you say that, because they did a movie version of Clue. And the kicker, and this was a big deal in the 80s especially, was that they sent it out with three different endings.
Multiple
endings.
And the
theater owner could choose which ending to stick on for the final reel. And that was the part of the fun. Although I don't think Clue was a huge success until later. It sort of caught on as a cult following more than a mainstream theatrical issue. Yeah.
And before that, Murder by Death, The Cheap Detective.
Yeah, yeah. I like Murder by Death a lot more than Cheap Detective, by the way. That sort of felt like, in a way, sort of a reboot of Murder by Death or something. And it was the same. It was not Neil Diamond. It was Neil Simon who wrote both of those. But yeah. Those and Murder on the Orient Express, which should come out in 1974, Sidney Lumet had made that. So yeah, they're
which
always going to go back.
Which then came out again last year with an with Kenneth Branagh and an impossibly huge mustache.
Didn't see that one. You know, I think I can see it on Amazon for free, and yet I'm still not watching that one. I don't need it. I don't need it. Yeah, it's free,
you know,
but it's
ends.
2 hours of my life. I don't want to give that to that.
So are there do you have any year-end recommendations before the new stuff starts hitting? You got any year-end recommendations for things that happened this year?
TV.
Go see these, that kind of?
Well, not much. You know, it's mostly TV that I do have recommendations, and they're ones that probably everybody has seen, but I've seen them too. Have you seen Watchmen yet?
I do not have HBO. I'm eager
yeah,
to
I don't
see
either.
It.
I get it through Amazon. You know, I stream it. I stream HBO for like $5 a month. I can do.
Ooh, I can do that. HBO. Can I? Yeah, I wasn't even thinking about.
Yeah, and you can quit whenever you want.
One of the funny things is, you know, here I am. I do an internet broadcast. It's all, you know, technical magic and everything. And I realized yesterday I'm kind of a Luddite where creating playlists and thinking mm-hmm. about the digital universe are concerned. I mean,
right.
I'm down here in Civilization or something, a vague approximation of it. Okay, I'm talking to a guy in New York. But, when I want lunch, I get in the car and I drive out to a restaurant, if I'm not cooking for myself, and I sit down and have lunch.
Right.
Like the Chinese restaurant last night where I had.
And that's a good thing.
I had a really interesting impression or an interesting take on Szechuan hot pot. And it was really good.
I don't doubt it.
But I could have just gone online, registered with Grubhub or DoorDash, and they would have happily brought it to me. But I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Because I'm an old fart. And you get in the car and you go and you eat.
Yeah, but here's what old farts get that the youngins don't get, is that when you do that, you get to go outside. You get to look at buildings and places that you may be familiar with, but maybe there's something that catches your eye that you hadn't noticed before, or an attractive or an interesting person. And maybe you run into somebody, or maybe you share a joke or two with the person who serves you the food. There's all kinds of potential entertainments along the way between your hunger and getting the food into your mouth. Whereas if you're sitting there waiting for the food to come, all of your entertainment comes probably these days from a phone or a laptop and whatever is being presented to you. And that's all wonderful too, but there is something to getting your ass outside and going around and keeping your eyes open and just noticing things, or giving yourself the opportunity to speak with a complete and utter stranger that maybe there's insight that day. If nothing else, it's just damn interesting. And there are, trust me, there are.
You make me feel so much better.
Yeah,
because
everything
you just said is what I do.
Right, your job is to talk and to listen to people, and it's not just a job; it's a wonderful avocation, right? It's a pleasure to do that. I think. I mean, yeah, we run into all kinds of people in the supermarket that want to have 20-minute conversations about why the price of raisins is too damn high, and you eventually want to just scoot away from them. But even that, you come home and you can say, "Yeah, honey, I met this just alarmingly annoying person, and you know she's going to give herself a heart attack over the price of raisins. You know, I'm actually kind of worried about it." You know,
my wife Agnes is the queen of that.
About the prices of things.
No. About people bringing her into the most intimate recesses of their life. Uh-huh. I mean, she's had telemarketers that she can't get them off the phone. And then they've quit trying to sell her stuff long before. And instead they're just, "Well, you know, my mom and dad broke up when I was 9 and tell them you got to go, baby."
Yeah.
And yeah, so they open their hearts and their lives to her. And it can happen on a telephone. It can happen in a restaurant. It can happen anywhere out in the wandering world. And even the person who delivers Grubhub or DoorDash or Grub South or whatever is like, if we had it up there in West Virginia, she would be likely to open the door and the person would hand her meal and begin telling her his life story.
Yeah,
some people are just magnets for that.
Yeah. No, it's a wonderful thing. It's storytelling, in a way. We all share bits and pieces of our life stories. Not literally. I rarely tell people, I was born in the Keysport Hospital and But I do regularly share little bits and pieces of what my life is and has become through saying, I saw this movie. It said this thing to me. I felt this way about it. Or, how are your kids doing? Well, of course, I'm going to tell you about my kids. And when I tell you about my kids, in a way, I'm telling you about me and my life because they're so important to it, or my wife. We do share little bits and pieces of ourselves every day, and we should. It is a danger with social media. Especially when I first got on Facebook, I had to learn the difference between sharing and oversharing, and also to respect the privacy of the people who around me, my wife, my children, my friends, my employers. There are things that I should not say, and I had to learn how to not say them. So it's very tempting at first. It's very tempting to just say all kinds of stupid things into this new microphone I got. But
I'm loving the new microphone.
I don't know how you avoid stupidity doing this 3 hours a night every night.
Oh, no. It's a feature, not a flaw.
Right. I kind of set you up with that one.
You have to be open to the stupid, because 16 years of this and you're going to do a rather probably sizable chunk of it. Yeah. By the way, you got a note from our pal Lady B.
Oh,
a new heart literally is the gift of life. Dan, I hope you had and continue having many wonderful Christmases. Stay healthy. But, because there's always a but.
Always a but. Everybody has a big but.
And I cannot lie.
Did I say something?
And I cannot lie.
Okay, but what's
the
but?
You other brothers can't deny. Never mind. But Lady B asks, is getting a new heart, does it qualify as a ship of Theseus issue? I mean, it's a pretty big deal. No heart, no you. Yet you're still you. How many parts have to be replaced before Dan becomes a futuristic cyborg badass named Dan 3000? At least we'd still have you around to tell your wonderful stories. Anyway, strange musings, and I'm not even stoned, .. Have an interesting and fun show, says Lady B. Thank you, Lady B. Wonderful as always.
It's not like a 1970s horror movie starring Michael Caine. The person, honestly and seriously, the person who donated his heart, that became my heart, had been in prison. I don't know for what offense. But it's not like, if that person had been imprisoned for murder that I would have any compulsion. I don't have any compulsion to murder people, Lady B. Be assured of that. Nobody's going to die around me anytime soon, by my hands at least. So, do you remember there was a movie, I think, called The Hand?
Yes.
Where I think Michael Caine gets a hand transplant, and it turns out it was the hand of a killer, and he starts getting these impulses to strangle people and stuff. That's not going to happen to me. Don't worry about that. I wouldn't mind being Michael Caine because he's effortlessly charming. But the murder part I can do without, and I think I will. But thank you. Yeah, I'm doing fine with the heart. If you have any newbies to your show, the short story long is that, yes, 1 year and 3 months ago, I underwent a heart transplant operation successfully at New York Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, one of the top facilities for that in the United States. And I'm very super lucky in that I'm doing well with it, but that I also have such capable doctors and a wonderful nursing staff to take care of me. I have a caretaker at home, my wife, who who has done so much for me. You know, I have such a support system of friends and coworkers and a psychotherapist. You know, all these people are looking out for me and making sure that, you know, that this thing, I'm going to stick around for a while. I'm going to do it in a pretty healthy manner. And I have fantastic health insurance to pay for all of this. And this is coming off as braggy now, and I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry that not every single
I mean, we're liberal, but we're not apologize for being alive, liberal Dan.
No, but I do wish that every single person had the luxuries I have. That every single facility in the United States, or at least every state, had a top notch heart, anything facility. That every person had the ability to have top level expert care, and that it would all be paid for. I wish for that for people, and it should be something that could be taken care of in the most prosperous nation in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I still find it somewhat surprising that no offense to, you know, Presbyterian there that did such magnificent work with you, the best heart hospital in the country is in Cleveland.
Uh-huh. My sister's they never married, but my sister's former partner, my older sister, had cancer, and he went to that place in Cleveland, and they're wonderful. They're wonderful places everywhere, and I don't mean to be like New York, ha ha ha, where the
But you know, it makes sense, for instance, that the number one cancer hospital in the United States is in Houston, because that particular neck of the woods has been turned into a toxic cancer waiting room by the petrochemical and hydrocarbon industry.
Yeah. But, you know, and what I do know from social media and having friends who moved to all over the map or what have you, is that there are people receiving terrible health care. And some of it is stuff that can be, you know, taken care of with money. And some things are just by teaching professionals how to be human beings and not assholes. It's startling.
Well, I mean, your native state is one of those places.
That has assholes? No, most definitely.
No, that has horrible healthcare access.
What WVU has had its first heart transplant this year.
Yeah.
So, you know, good for them. Let's keep it going. But we can only keep it going, and here's the pitch to your listeners. We can only keep it going when we have a multitude of donors, and not just of hearts. Donate all of your organs. Be an organ donor. I'm personally giving up my whole body. When I go, it's not going in a hole. They can take whatever is useful from my body, the flesh, the eyes. I don't care, because I'm not going to feel it. Whatever they do to me, I'm not going to know about it. I'm going to be dead. And yet everything that can be done with that body can be of use, either directly by plugging an organ into a needing donor, or for research purposes to cure things and to help people understand things, and young medical students to learn how to be doctors and nurse practitioners.
Okay, I'm gonna ask you a hard question.
Oh God. Yes.
And it's based on ripped from the headlines, dum dum. You probably worked on that show at some point in time. Did you ever work on Law and Order?
Did I ever work on Law and Order? The original?
Any of
original,
them. Law and Order,
Law
and Order UTI, you know, anything. What?
I did the original Law and Order from 1997 to 2005, what we would call the Jerry Orbach years.
Wow.
That was my time. In fact, I was on another podcast recently devoted just to that. I'll send you the link to it.
Oh, I'd love to listen to it.
Okay. The podcast is called Below the Line. And by the way, I'll plug that on the air, and maybe some of your listeners will be interested. And it's myself and two of my friends who also worked on the show, the camera operator, director of photography, and the boom operator. And for about an hour, we talk about the old days of having worked on Law and Order, with lots of backstage stories and things like that. So,
oh,
yes.
Fun.
Answer to your short question is yes, I worked on Law and Order. I did one episode of SVU, and I didn't care for it.
Yeah, well, I thought they just wore the franchise out when they got to Law and Order Crossing Guard Unit, Law and Order UTI. You know, there's only so far you can go.
Hey, all I know is that Dick Wolf sleeps on a mattress stuffed with $100 bills every night, and I don't. But okay, you know,
yeah, exactly. You do, yeah, sure. And you know, the smell of all that sweet, sweet money comes up through the mattress material.
Yeah, well, half of it went to the ex-Mrs. Dick Wolf, but that was another story.
But you know what? He's still not on rice and beans. Rod and Raleigh wrote a little bit ago and said, fair warning, talking about Knives Out. Fair warning, you know that Rian Johnson directed Knives Out. He's the one that that perpetrated The Last Jedi. Forewarned is forearmed.
All right. Well, I know that every director is capable of a masterpiece and a stinker. I Peter Bogdanovich made some brilliant movies, Last Picture Show, Paper Moon, and then he went on a string of stinkers and never recovered. Everybody, you know, the worst director, Bob Clark, who did A Christmas Story, you know, that was the one that's on 24 hours. You know, he also did all the Porky's movies. So nobody is either utterly brilliant or utterly terrible.
Or immune.
You know, maybe the guy that does all those Transformers, Michael Bay, he's just simply terrible. But again, he sleeps on a mattress full
stuffed
of $100 bills.
Yeah,
it goes swimming in a swimming pool full of gold coins like Scrooge McDuck.
By the way, the name of the movie, Rusty wrote in, The Beast of Five Fingers.
Really? I thought it was The Hand that was an early Oliver Stone, but The Beast with Five Fingers. I'll check that out. I might be wrong about The Hand. Could be about a different movie. There were a number of movies about transplant early on. There was one with Rosie Grier and Oscar winner Ray Milland called The Thing with Two Heads. It was made in 1972. And yeah, Ray Milland had won the Best Actor Oscar in 1945 for The Lost Weekend. But by 1971, you know, he was reduced to being strapped to the back of Rosie Grier to make it look like Rosie Grier had two heads. And they would do things like ride a motorcycle together or argue with one another. And that was like a serious movie.
It's a fate worse than death.
Seriously bad movie. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I do. I think about the great actors who wind up doing, because when it's in your blood, you can't stop.
Right.
And
right. John Carradine, a wonderful actor. I don't know if you remember the original Grapes of Wrath with Henry Fonda.
Sure.
In 1940.
And that voice.
He was the preacher. He was Casey. And he's brilliant in that movie. But John Carradine, in his last 10, 20 years, he would take anything. If you had a supermarket opening, he'd go there. He'd do it. And Martin Landau, even before, you know, in the years before he had his comeback, he did the Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's Island. You know, he everybody is capable of crap. That's one way of putting it.
And everybody loves to work.
Everybody loves to work. Sure. You catch me at the right time, offer me the right job, I'll do it. You know, sometimes I have to turn down something really great because I'm already on something.
Okay, so here's my hard question. And it goes back to the issue, and you know, don't hate me or anything. This is a...
Because you're beautiful?
Well, no, not because of that, because of the question I'm about to ask.
Okay.
So I read this story, and I don't think I ever actually got around to it on the air, because I kind of wanted to hear from you on it. Now, this was months ago.
Oh, God. Okay.
Because it has to, it's an organ/body donation story.
Okay.
And I am in the same camp as you. I mean, I don't have any dogs in the afterlife hunt.
Right.
So I figure, you know, there's, you know, chop me up and take me out to sea and troll me as chum, which would at least feed the sharks, or there's try to help somebody. I'd guess,
right.
My lungs and my heart are not going to be useful to anybody. I doubt a cannibal would even eat them.
Yes.
But there's got to be something about me that might be salvageable. So cool.
I know there is. I can 100% tell you this.
Skin.
Yes.
Skin. I got places
you
where
got
my skin's okay.
You got eyes. Jerry Orbach donated his eyes. Somebody's walking around with Jerry Orbach's eyes. Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
It's true. They don't even know it. That's the kicker. They don't know they have Jerry Orbach's eyes, but they do. Maybe it's you.
No, it's not me.
Okay.
But
there's
be,
a, was it, there a question? I forget.
Yeah, there is. And it's tied to a story.
Story, okay.
So this woman We don't need her name.
She doesn't go into a urinal, right? This isn't the Alabama story again.
No, I didn't really
laugh at that one.
No.
Okay,
no.
Woman. Yes, woman.
And it makes the Alabama-Auburn joke a lot harder if it's a couple of women.
It is, yeah.
No. What she did is she willed her body to medical science.
Yes.
Exactly what you were talking about.
What I'm going to do, yes.
But it turns out, and I think you and I are going to wind up in the same place. But there's just a little bit of something that's a little on the outrageous side about this.
Uh-oh.
The son and the family generally always thought, well, you know, when they're done with whatever they're going to do with her, they will. What if there's anything left, they will treat it with some degree of dignity.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think as humans, we still do have this dignity thing.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, no.
And it's important. Listen, it's about the survivors and being sensitive to their desires. Yes.
So he found out, and please believe me when I say this is not torn from the pages of the Weekly World News or the Globe or even Fox News.
Uh-huh.
This was a legitimate news story. And
I believe it.
And at the time I first saw it, I did what I do when I have any questions at all. I checked the sources and tried to make sure that it was real. It's a real story, Dan.
I believe, Brother Bob. I believe.
Amen. So when they were done with her, we'll call her Granny. When they were done with Granny, who had wanted nothing more for the end of her life than to try to continue to help people even after she was done with her body, noble as you have mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the family found out that they took what was left of her, gave it to the United States military, who strapped her to a bomb and blew her up.
Now, that's not nice.
It is, however, that's true. Not
nice. I mean, it's a hell of a way to go out. If you wanted
that. Well, if you're Hunter Thompson, you'd pay somebody to do that.
It's dramatic. You know, but if that isn't what you originally wanted, that doesn't help medical science in the least. That doesn't help preserve life. It's a bomb. You're helping to destroy it. So, yeah. No, that's not the good thing to do.
But apparently you can't put caveats on it.
Hmm.
And so you can it is, and based on what I was able to glean from it all, it was not the first time an organ or body donor had been strapped to an explosive and set off.
Well, listen, maybe this is me. Everybody's got different, very personal attachments to the idea of their bodies, corpses, and all this stuff. And this is a hell of a road to go down the day after Christmas. But I really do feel this isn't me. This is a casing of flesh. You know, it looks like this thing that people identify as me, but it's not me. What I am and what will, if anything, survives will be the actions and their influence that I had upon other people and things and so forth. And if people remember and can tell a story years later, if there are photographs, whatever I leave behind in whatever form, that is me. And if I believed in heaven, which I don't, but I respect that other people do, and they could be right and I could be wrong. But, you know, so you might think that, okay, well, soul goes to heaven. So, okay, fine. Your soul goes to heaven, but your body doesn't and your flesh doesn't. So in a lot of ways, it's like, well, if it goes strapped to a bomb and it gets blown up, that's extremely disrespectful. On the other hand, it doesn't really matter. I mean, I think the real answer to this, the real solution to this quandary, not just for this one unfortunate family, but to any others, is maybe there's things we're better off knowing. Like if you sign, like with the heart thing, it's done anonymously. I will never know who donated that heart to me. What I was asked to do was after I received the heart, I could, and I did, write a letter to the family, the surviving family, and say whatever I wanted, to thank them, which I did for their son's sacrifice or his gift to me. And because I knew that that son had been in prison, that much I did know. I didn't know a name and or anything else. I really thought it was important to let this family know, you know, whatever else, their son did something very important and meaningful and heroic. And I was grateful for that. And then I gave that letter to an organization within the hospital. And as a third party, they delivered it to the family. And the family could then choose to either respond back with a letter of their own or even, you know, let me know their name if they wanted, that sort of thing. But in this case, the family didn't, and I was perfectly fine with it. I just wanted to express my thanks. I wasn't necessarily looking for a second family or a bunch of new friends. I just wanted them
to notice. Or someone to add to the Christmas card list.
Right. So I do think, in a way, just like when you eat delicious sausage, some things are better off not known. That maybe when you do donate, whatever is used of it, however it's used, it's going to be what it is. Because, again, the flesh and the remaining flesh and bone, they don't really matter as much as you might think. They just they're just things. They're objects. They're nouns. What you are and were is up for history and possibly God to decide.
What do you think of people who do the Disney and pay to have their heads frozen?
God, if that's what they want to do, it's their bodies, their choice. They want to freeze their. But what actually becomes of the heads? So the idea is that if they ever come up with a miracle cure, the heads are then transplanted onto a healthy body or something like that. Is that how it's done?
Yeah, they're saying. I guess what? Maybe one of the things they expect to do in the coming year is perform the first successful human head transplant.
Yeah, you know, this is going down medical ethical issues that go way beyond my understanding. Maybe it's a good Michael Crichton novel, but you know, because at first it sounds really cool. Hey, what if we could have like at least Walt Disney's brain and put that into a still surviving body? Hey, we could have all these great cartoons and stories and things like that. It's Disney lives again. But then, you know, what if it's Hitler? You know, what if it's Charles Manson? It's just like maybe we're just all better off letting new brains be new brains and new ideas be their own, belonging to their own unique person.
I think maybe that's why on Futurama, of all the people they could have used to typify of a head in a jar, they chose Richard Nixon.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is an idea that's gone. You know, listen, Mary Shelley did it too with Frankenstein. You know, she was examining just because we can, should we? If we could create life, should we do that? What are the consequences of such inspiration? You know, I mean, Oppenheimer was famously regretful for having been part of the development of the bomb.
Lo, I am become death, the destroyer of worlds.
Right. You know, the internet has been a marvelous, wonderful thing.
A distant relative, of his is a friend
at the last minute, but it also helped us, you know, elect a terrible human being as a president. There's no doubt in my mind that without the internet, without Twitter, there is no President Trump. You know, would we be willing to give up if we could get in a time machine
with a more vigorous immigration policy in 19 whatever? We wouldn't have a Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
See, I'm of the opinion that, you know, we're living in Trump-merica now.
Right.
And I remember the other day when you urged me to spend Christmas morning running down Main Street yelling, "Hello, building and loan. Merry Christmas, old."
Merry Christmas, yo, building and loan.
You do
Hello,
that.
Hello, Bedford Falls. Yes.
Yeah. You get a cowbell for your Jimmy Stewart there. I'm sorry.
I went from Orson Welles to Jimmy Stewart. I'm kind of versatile.
You're a multiple threat is what you are. But I didn't.
Well, the voice is rising. By the way, you notice I'm no longer in Orson. You know, I was actually kind of not really Orson. I was more in like Lucille Ball in her final years. You know, oh, we need a little Christmas. Jesse, get me another cigarette. You know, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Jesus, where was I going? Well, anyway, I didn't do that because I didn't write back to say, but, you know, down here, I think you'd get arrested.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I did. I actually did that once in my hometown of Middleburn, West Virginia, population 800 and something. One Christmas Eve, I did run around, not the whole town, but I not down Main Street, but I ran around the block around the house I grew up in my stocking feet, yelling like Jimmy Stewart. I just felt like it. That's all. Probably I had some alcohol in me.
A little eggnog on Christmas morning never hurts anybody. But anyway, my larger point is that I think we're living in an alternate universe now.
Yes, Trump.
We are in the Pottersville part of the movie. Mm. Because once upon a time, there was no demon handy to encourage Donald Trump to kill himself. Mm. And if he had, we'd all be living in a happy America. But instead, he didn't, and so we're in Pottersville.
Well, you know, some people say that it was really that one Washington Press Corps dinner.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the White House Correspondents Association when Obama savaged him.
Yeah, and that just fed the fire. And you know, to the right things came into congregation at the same time. He had a reality television show, so he had visibility, and he was him. You hurt his feelings, so he's gonna come back at you tenfold because that's the Trumpian way of doing things. You know, if maybe, you know, prior to that dinner, somebody said, you know what, this guy's just a schmuck who's on a reality TV show. We don't need these jokes about him. Let's go off in other directions here. If somebody had done that, you know, maybe we wouldn't have President Trump. I don't know who we'd have. I guess.
Yeah,
so.
But I remember in the early aughts when God, I think Rush Limbaugh interviewed him. And that
Trump?
Far, yeah, and that far yeah. Back, he was thinking about a presidential campaign.
Right. Well, and then also, of course, he got on board the birther boat and rode that all the way. And that was very appealing to certain people who just really did not like the idea of a black man with a funny name being the president representing the United States of America.
Yeah, certain people who go to meetings where they wear 300 thread count per kale sheets and pillowcases on their heads.
But not even those. Not, you know, the people that begin their sentences with, I'm not a racist, but those people.
Yes.
By the way, folks, if you ever hear somebody say the phrase, I'm not a racist, but stand back because you're about to hear the most racist shit in your life.
Oh, yeah. Or just generally realize this person just confessed to being a racist.
Yeah, it's always the but. It's the same when somebody apologizes to you and say, I'm really sorry, but.
Conjunction, what's your function?
And make it your fault. Every time. There should be no but. At least in that case. I mean, I forget, our friend Lady B said something with a but. And I made the joke, everybody has a big but, which comes from Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Everyone I know has a big but. But in general, we should avoid big butts. We should just say what we say, try to say it humbly and sincerely, and not be racist, which really is the theme of many an Academy Award-winning Best Picture movie. Basically, a lot of movies are about racism sucks and the end.
And that message was certainly enough to sway the Academy in 1962. And break the hearts of both David Lean and Peter O'Toole.
Are you talking about Sidney Poitier?
No, I'm talking about when To Kill a Mockingbird won out over Lawrence of Arabia.
It didn't. Lawrence of Arabia won Best Picture in 62. Gregory Peck beat out
Gregory Peck beat out Peter O'Toole.
Yeah, and Anne Bancroft won Best Actress that year.
Because you and I have already been over the whole Steve Landisberg doing Gregory Peck bit.
Yeah. Oh, he does a fantastic Gregory Peck.
What is it? Brenda. Brenda is not here. I don't do Gregory Peck. Maybe
I can't.
Do.
I can't either. You know who does a surprisingly good one is Gilbert Gottfried. He does Gregory Peck, not in To Kill a Mockingbird or any of those old. He does him in The Boys from Brazil. Remember that one? 1970s.
Yes.
Nazi cloning thriller. He does a Gregory Peck in Boys of Brazil. It's very good. He does also an excellent James Mason. I'm sorry, my dear. You know James Mason.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that kind of thing. But was there a point to this whole entire podcast? I forget if there's a point.
You're kind of asking the wrong question at 16 point some odd years in, really.
Yeah.
Going back to work, actors being willing to do anything. Rusty said, I saw DeForest Kelly at a small waterbed shop in Cupertino in 1970. Really, he was there to promote the grand opening.
Oh, that's something. Yeah. Well, you know, there are actually now, I guess it's become a really huge business. These, not only the Comic-Con, but there's all kinds of fan fests and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
In a lot of ways, you know, it's very easy for us to go, oh, how pathetic, oh, how sad, you know, that somebody's trading in on their, you know, that they were on a 60s show or something. But on the other hand, you know, look, if I had once been hot shit on television for about 3 years and then that was it, you damn well I'd go out to some Holiday Inn in the middle of New Jersey to sign autographs for 8 hours and have people tell me how wonderful I am and give me money for that. Hell yeah, I'd do that.
Pays for the scotch.
And there's nothing wrong with people telling you, you know, how meaningful you made their lives because you used to fire phasers at a man in a big monkey suit or something, you know. That's all right.
Well, that's why Galaxy Quest remains one of my favorite films.
You know, I've never seen that movie. It's true.
Oh.
It's one of the ones that I'm trying to work on a series called Well, I Never, where I will finally see a movie that everybody has seen and then write about it like 15 years or 30 years after the fact. Like I've never seen Flashdance. It just never happened for me. I did see Top Gun, but you know, I hated it and I've never seen it since. But no, really, all of these, I've only seen one of the Avengers movies. And even that, you know, I remember nothing about it. So that's an idea I have for a future regular series of Facebook posts is something called Well, I Never. I might also expand it into albums and stuff. Like I've never listened to a complete Grateful Dead album from beginning to end because as far as I'm concerned, I hate their music.
Yeah, okay. So you're going to get now having
but maybe I'm being unfair.
Having endeared yourself to the Horn Family Community Congregation, you will now get hate mail from a certain portion thereof. You don't love the Dead? Fuck you, man.
You know, well, that gets into a whole other subject I actually did want to talk about tonight, which is that in this age of everything being quote-unquote politicized, where everything now is a fucking argument, what I really hate to see, and I see it, it's like I see people saying fuck you, man, about all kinds of pop culture. It's like, can't we just not argue? Like, if we're going to quote unquote argue, let's do it in a way that's not like hostile and threatening. It's one thing to make fun of the thing with two heads or even the Avengers or whatever. So I didn't like it. I think it's childish. But I have friends that are like, you know, super, super into the Marvel Universe stuff and super into Star Wars. And it's like, you know, oh, Marty Scorsese says that, you know, the Marvel Universe movies are, you know, infantilizing America. Fuck him. He's a terrible filmmaker. It's like, no, he's not a terrible filmmaker. He just doesn't like the thing you like. And you know what? Everybody doesn't like something, but nobody doesn't like Sara Lee.
I even remember the jingle, the melody.
Everybody doesn't like
Sara Lee.
But nobody doesn't like Sara Lee. But my point is, again, this is just, it's just phony baloney Hollywood nonsense. We don't, it's not the basis of your life, or it shouldn't be, that, you know, whether or not Greedo shot first or whether your childhood was ruined because they dared to put women in a Ghostbusters movie. It's let it be what it is. Let it be entertainment. Let it be inspiration. Let it be something you want to do with your life. But don't be an asshole to people because they don't like things. Now, one could say, now, why does Scorsese even have to say anything then about Marvel? Fair enough. You know, it's old man yelling at the clouds. It's, hey, get off my lawn to some extent. I get what he's saying, though. You know, if every movie out there is Star Wars and is Marvel and is a sequel or a reboot, where's there room for originality? Where's there room for a story we haven't heard before? And where is room for complexity?
Well, you were talking earlier, Dan, about the fact that most of your recommendations have to do with TV.
Mm-hmm.
Is the current answer you caught my lead on?
You know, my lead in was a forward pass to you. And you caught it, and you're heading for the end zone as we speak.
And the answer to where is the room? Where's the room to make that stuff? And
the it's on this thing that we now vaguely call TV, but it's not really even TV,
right?
You know, TV is a thing in my living room that's a large screen, and that I barely even watch. I barely look at this thing. It comes on a couple of times a year. Mostly, what I consider TV is something that I lie down on my back, I put it on my stomach. And I watch this thing on my laptop screen, and that stuff is fantastic, you know. And you ask me what I'm watching, I recommend to you and to everybody Watchmen. Watch Watchmen. It is not only I read the graphic novel way back. I have it, and I'm rereading it right now. But it's not a superhero movie in that way. It's people sometimes punching people and sometimes getting. Something that you might call justice. But what it really is, let me put it this way. The very first scene in Watchmen, episode one, the first scene is a recreation of a real-life incident in Tulsa, Oklahoma,
yes.
Where black people were massacred in the streets. That's your opening scene. And that becomes one of the characters as a little boy, witnesses that and escapes from that, and thus begins our story.
Yeah, and no further details, lest we be accused of spoiling.
Right, and you know, from there we know this is not just a bing bang pow. You know, you get yours, Joker. You're going to jail. This is much more than that. It's really the first Black Lives Matter television show, and it was made by a white man, Damon Lindelof. But by God, it's powerful stuff. And there's, I think, 9 episodes. And there's ones where I watched at least, and I was just stunned. And it does take on white privilege. There's a scene where a white character, right before he's about to die, turns to a black character and says, "Look, man, we're just trying to help you." And to me, that was one of the most powerful moments, because that's that condescending, unintentional racism that all of us white people are capable of. We're just trying to help you people. You people, as if they're a different species than us, the default species. I can't give it justice. And I am like one of those friends at work that says, "Oh, you got to watch this thing." And meanwhile, you know, every day somebody tells you got to watch something else. There's too much. There's such a backlog of things. But that was the most affecting, and I think entertaining, and thought provoking, and just visually splendid show I've seen this year. By far. I like Succession a lot, which is 180 degrees from Watchmen. Now that's about rich white people.
Is that the one with Brian Cox?
That is with Brian Cox, also on HBO. You know, HBO did something very, very smart. I don't know if it was by design or circumstance, where, you know, Game of Thrones was ending. Oh my God, how are we going to keep people, you know, how are we going to keep them on watching HBO and paying those monthly subscription fees? Well, they did a 1-2 of a first of Succession and then Watchmen after that. Succession is people that I avoided watching it forever, because I'm like, I've already seen Dallas and all these rich people doing the rich people conniving. But by God, this is a funny show. It's a very touching show, dramatic. And they do the miraculous thing of taking people you would hate in real life and making them interesting enough that you can't wait to see what they do next. And that is quality writing and quality acting and everything. It's just, it's very well done. A lot of the shows that I liked, they have either women characters or black characters, or behind the camera or behind the scenes. Fleabag season 2 was better than season 1, and I liked season 1 a lot. Season 2 was powerful stuff and funny and sexy. Russian Doll, have you seen that? That's on Netflix.
No.
That's kind of like it's kind of like what is it, Groundhog Day.
Yes, I did see that. I did see that. Yeah.
Now, you know, I think it has more something to you if you're a city person. I have a real sentimental attachment to that show because it was filmed in the neighborhood, literally in the neighborhood I used to live on, the block I used to live on. So it's like, oh, there's the bar. That's the Horseshoe Bar on the corner, which was two doors down from us. There's the deli we used to go into all the time for diapers and juice and things like that. But it's a terrific, funny show, and I liked it a lot. There's just did you see When They See Us?
Yes.
About the Central Park Five?
Yes.
You know, powerful stuff. But, you know, when you say that to people, like powerful stuff or, oh, it's, you know, very gripping, it sounds really boring or, oh, I just want to be entertained. But there is entertainment value in watching these things. You know, it's not like I sat there bored.
I can never resist in a conversation like this. I can never resist a reference to ancient Greece. Back then, you didn't have a crowd who only went to the comedies. There was a reason they carried both masks.
Mm.
And you appreciated the tragedy for what it provided you, the human experience it provided you. And then you went and you laughed and peed yourself at all the actors walking around with 4-foot penises sticking out from under their togas in the comedies.
You got to have both. You got to have it all. Yesterday I was at a Christmas gathering with family members, and I have some, you know, whatever they are, second nephews once removed or something like that in their 20s. And they're pretty cool kids and everything, but we were talking about, you know, the variety of entertainment available. And one of them said, like, well, you know, I just like all the Marvel stuff, and I'd rather watch that than, you know, all of this other sort of more socially redeeming stuff. And I said, well, just think of it this way. Think of entertainment like food. Now, Marvel movies and superhero and Star Wars, they're all hamburgers. Now, I'm not saying that condescendingly. A great hamburger is an extraordinary meal. You can't believe when you bite into just the best hamburger with the perfect toppings.
Right, but a steady diet of hamburgers will make you hate hamburgers, and a hamburger is not the same thing as Chateaubriand.
But sometimes all you want, sometimes all I want, even though I'm not allowed to eat it anymore, sometimes all you want is a good hamburger.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong, no reason to apologize for that. But if all you do every time you eat is eat a hamburger, you're going to be a big, fat, disgusting, boring slob. You need to occasionally eat a salad. You need to occasionally get something like some French food in you, some Italian food. You need to get some soul food into you. You need these other tastes.
Fiber and greens. Fiber and greens.
Fiber, greens, but also you need to know what the world tastes like. You also need to know what other – when I swing the metaphor back around to entertainment, we need to know how other people who are not us and who are not superheroes, we need to know how they think and feel. We need to understand other people, and we need to be entertained by them. It isn't just a history lesson. It's not just a sociology lesson. Give women filmmakers a chance. Give black filmmakers an opportunity to tell you their stories, and not just about slavery, and not just about driving a Miss Daisy all over the goddamn place. Let them tell all the stories.
that's the sequel now, isn't it? Driving Miss Daisy all over the goddamn place.
All the goddamn place. Yeah, I'm driving her crazy or something. And who would be Miss Daisy in a reboot? Can you imagine that? A driving Miss Daisy reboot?
Jesus.
Who would we put into that now? Jane Fonda, maybe? Yeah, I think Jane Fonda.
Yeah, she's...
And it'll be terrible. It'll be absolutely atrocious.
Jane Fonda's doing good activist work in D.C.
Oh, she's great. But I'm just saying a Driving Miss Daisy reboot. Oh, no.
I just can't conceive of one.
Thankfully, nobody else has either. But Hollywood, if you pick up on this idea, please send me a check for $10,000.
Yeah, if you pick up on it, Dan's suing.
Yeah, I'll sue. And I won't win, but I'll sue anyway.
They'll settle.
That's how this stuff works.
They'll settle.
You get clogged up in the court system, and eventually you'll pay me off because you'll be tired of me. The end.
And you'll sleep in a mattress stuffed with $100 bills.
And go swimming in a pool filled with gold coins, just like Scrooge McDuck.
Precisely.
And there were things that were culturally, since we're talking culture, there were disappointments this year, I thought. I really liked the first Stranger Things a lot. I liked the second Stranger Things okay. I did not like the third Stranger Things. Did you see that one? Have you seen any of them?
No, that was that. I didn't think that was up my alley.
Well, the first one I think you might like because it's deliberately an homage to 1980s horror films, and it's even filmed
I didn't go
in
to,
style.
But Dan, I didn't go to horror films in the 1980s.
Oh, that's right. You hate horror films. I forgot about that. Right?
Yeah. In fact, just the other day, I met my my I don't know. Sister from another mother or whatever, because and we just a bunch of us were talking and I heard her say, "Oh no, I don't do horror movies." Mm. And I just looked at her and said, "I'm the other one." And she went, ah.
Fair enough. But the point is too about Stranger Things 3 or whatever. I haven't seen Frozen 2 yet. My feeling is, yeah, there are some stories that can be continued and you can keep finding new and interesting ways to tell them. Or sometimes just following the rigid format is enough. James Bond seems to work that way. Listen, I loved all the Planet of the Apes movies when I was a kid. There were five of them in the 1970s. I've watched a lot of them since and they're not great movies, but still okay. But what we should know, but we don't, we continually forget, is that most stories really don't require a chapter 2, 3, or 4. You know, if Jason is killed at the end of Friday the 13th, that's a satisfying ending. That's a psychopath who's out chasing half-clothed, attractive young people, and eventually somebody outsmarts him and destroys him. The end. I don't need to see personally that he wasn't really dead, or he comes back as another person.
No, the only people who want to see that is the accounting department.
That's really it. Somebody wants a second beach house. Somebody needs a new coat of gold on the outside of their yacht, and so you get a part 2, 3, 4 until whenever somebody decides to stop. I mean, why do we keep making Terminator movies? I mean, I think the last 3 or 4 of them have been quote unquote disappointments, but yet nobody takes the hint that
because
maybe
people
we're
go
tired
to
of that story.
Right. Because they've been disappointment, but people go to them. I mean, look, I spent money. I went to see The Last Jedi. I swore all the way home. I did practically a 3-hour filibobster the following Monday, trying to issue just a crushing brief against that what I perceive to be horrible, horrible, horrible movie. And I don't do that. I don't go to the movies that often, but generally speaking, if I see something I don't like, I turn it off. The one thing is, if I've spent money on a movie ticket, I sit there.
Right. That's true. I don't walk out of movies. What was I going to say? Oh, you had something really – you were so impassioned, and I had something great to say, but I didn't want to interrupt you, and now I'm forgetting what it is. But I do think, honestly, for as much as I've been kind of critical of Marvel movies, I do think what they – from the ones I've seen about probably 4 or 5 out of the 20 or so that have been made. But what they do – what those movies do really well is they do connect – the characters and the storylines to one another so that it can form something of a linear. That's what comic books do too anyway, you know, that they connect it into something of a linear overall story arc, a universe.
Yeah, and I confess
I give credit to that.
I love, I think it's the only ones I've really seen, but I love the two Guardians of the Galaxy movies.
I saw the first one. I love that one a lot. I haven't seen the second.
The person who puts the soundtracks together is a fucking genius.
Yeah. The soundtracks for me, you know, that tickled my sweet spot, 1970s radio. Yeah.
And the funny thing is, it tickled the sweet spots of people of a generation that didn't know it had that sweet spot to be tickled.
Mm.
My kids are in love with the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtracks now.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I can be manipulated as easily as the next movie goer. I love Groot. I think there's something wrong with you if you don't love Groot.
Yeah. Baby Groot got a little overdone, you know, like I'm sure Baby Yoda is going to be overdone.
Yeah. I can't conceive Baby Yoda.
There's plenty of young viewers that want to get the plush toys. Sure. And the stickers. Yeah,
don't take it away from them.
And let them have it. You were
talking about the difficulty of storylines too, and especially, you know, you're talking about Stranger Things. Good, awesome in season one. Okay in season two. Season three, meh. It is intensely difficult for a series to maintain that level of quality and interest. But you've worked on a couple that are one of which is legendarily one such, and the other I think will eventually be legendarily one such. Is there a magic formula, or is that what everybody's looking for? Is the magic formula?
Yeah, as William Goldman, the legendary Hollywood screenwriter, said, nobody knows anything. It's all a matter of some things just adapt to different formats. I mean, what is really wonderful again about Watchmen is that I tried watching the movie version that came out about 5 or 6 years ago. The guy that made the 300 movies, Zack Snyder, and I couldn't get through it. I couldn't get through the first half hour. And it works as a series. Now, what the series does too is it doesn't tell that same story that we know from the graphic novel. They continue it like 30 years later with mostly different characters. But the creators of that show really knew how to take that world and adapt it into something interesting. There is no magic formula. It's just a matter of talent. And sometimes, again, it's a matter of matching up the right talent with the right project. There are many wonderful filmmakers or television producers who have failed.
Does a writing staff remain in place over the course of 6 or 7 or 8 seasons?
Mostly. The Americans, we had, I think, a pretty consistent writing staff. And it was also just very well cast, you know, as it were. That we had writers of different... different experience levels and different cultural levels. We had a black woman on the crew, and there were very few black characters on our show. But she also, besides being a black woman, also happened to be a fabulously talented and is a very talented playwright. And she is now she wrote the screenplay for the upcoming Aretha Franklin movie called Respect. So this is a person with enormous talent. And what she brought to the writing overall, I don't know. You know, that's the thing too. Everybody dumps their part of the recipe in to the big pot, and it boils. They stir it up, and it becomes this thing. But what it also takes for a show are a showrunner or showrunners. In the case of the Americans, we had two of them that just have a command of the material, and whatever the multitude of writers brings to it. They make it coherent and have a consistent voice and tone.
So whether it's the Americans or Law and Order or classically the Sopranos, The Wire,
yes.
Breaking Bad.
Well, and stuff now, like Fleabag was originally written as a one-woman show for Phoebe Waller-Bridge. And somebody said, hey, would you develop this into a show? And she found a way to do it. Instead of one woman, it's It's a lot of it's enough characters to make it an interesting television show. But what there is, and I'm sure she had a writing staff. What there is is it definitely feels like it's coming from one specific voice and one specific perspective. That is something that some shows are better at doing than others. What worked with Law and Order was that structure, was that people wanted to see pretty much the same episode over and over again. It's that impulse we have when we're very small children and our folks show us a videotape of a cartoon or whatever, or let's say before videotape. You and I were small children before there were such things as videotapes. Our parents tell us a story and our impulse is, again, I want to hear that again. You know, it just hit that quote unquote sweet spot. I want that stimulated me. It made me feel great.
Or up into my teenage years, Warner Brothers cartoons would be on when I came home from
absolutely
high school.
Hey,
burnt into my brain.
I still play Elton John's greatest hits. It's in my iPhone library. I don't, you know, I'm not a huge Elton John fan. It's not like I have, you know, he's put out about 50 albums and all I have is that one, the greatest hits. But I listen to that quite a bit because I, you know, it's like I know that certain songs are going to be on there and they're going to do certain things as I drive and I listen to it. And I know I'm going to skip over maybe a few of them. I'm not as big a fan of your song, but I love, you know, Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting or Daniel. Anyway, so, and that's what Law and Order
did. Of course you
do,
Daniel.
Of course. Well, my sister used to sing that for me too. Daniel, my brother. But you listen, you watch Law and Order, you know the format. Everybody could potentially write a Law and Order, but yet not everybody could do it well. The secret is that, yeah, within that very strict format, you're going to have ideas happen. You're going to have somebody say, well, I killed this person because of this reason. And then you have to ask yourself, yeah, killing is bad, but that's kind of an interesting thought exploring reason,
something slightly more prosaic, you know, Murder, She Wrote. There's a happy little town somewhere and things are going swimmingly and Jessica Fletcher comes to visit and people die.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you'd figure out after a while, they'd say, Jessica, maybe you ought to,
there's a sign outside town, Jessica Fletcher, don't let the sun set on you here. You know, sorry, I can never resist a resort to a cheap laugh like that. So let's talk a little bit about Dan's World.
What do you want to know about it? It's kind of boring.
You've gone back to work and you've done stuff for Apple TV, and I mean, what can you tell us?
Well, as usual with Apple TV, I'm limited in what I'm allowed to say about what I'm currently working on. I worked on this show, Dickinson, which did come out. And I watched the first two episodes. It's not meant for my demographic. That show was about young Emily Dickinson, played by Hailee Steinfeld. But
is she the one that was in the recent remake of True Grit a few years
back? That is true. Well, recent if you call 2010 recent, but yes.
Stop it.
But yes, that's her, all right. And she plays Emily Dickinson. And the period trappings, the costumes are 100% period authentic. But yet, when they start talking, they deliberately speak in current slang. They'll say things like, you know, don't freak out, mom, or, you know, totally, and things like that. And really? There's also hip-hop music on the soundtrack. These are all deliberate artistic choices. It's not like they just didn't know that.
They're trying to make Emily approachable for a new generation.
Yeah, exactly.
Because she was damn sure too weird for her own.
My daughter. The demographic is Phoebe Fisher, 20-year-old Phoebe Fisher. And even she liked it but didn't love it. She's like, I get it. I get what they're trying to do. You know, I thought some of the other characters were more interesting than Emily Dickinson, and I wanted to know more about them.
That reminds me of the 1990s treatment of Romeo and Juliet with
Leo
DiCaprio.
And
Claire. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, not my thing. Not my thing. MTV, Romeo and Juliet. But listen, we're going to keep going over that one. You know, it's going to be West Side Story. It's going to be, you know, the reboot of West Side Story, which is coming out by Steven Spielberg, will be in your theaters next
Christmas.
Well,
you know, at least it's not J.J. Abrams.
At least it's not Cats.
What the hell happened? I'm so glad you mentioned it, because I remember going to see it when it was on the road early, you know, back in the 80s. Uh-huh. I went to the Fabulous Fox Theater and saw the traveling company of it in Atlanta. And it was like, yeah, okay, memories. Yeah, all right, good.
Right.
But I got the sneaking suspicion that I would have been a wealthy man if I had had the no-dose concession there.
No, I mean, it was a hit for a reason. I mean, this is the thing. We all love to trash Cats. It's this year's favorite hate watch, right? Those who actually go to see it, which isn't that many, not that many people have seen it. But listen, in the 80s, it was huge. And it continued to be huge into the 2000s. I mean, that was the thing, too. It really changed Broadway and what Broadway musicals were about.
Yeah, it ramped up the degree to which Broadway could be spectacle.
Not only that, but also think about it, too. I think that was the first Broadway show where that logo, the Cats logo, suddenly it's on shirts. I saw, I was a theater department major in 1982 to 86. I saw every other person in the creative arts facility was wearing a Cats T-shirt. But there were mugs. There were all kinds of bumper stickers. It was a phenomenon, and it was a collectible phenomenon. Everybody had the soundtrack album, etc. But people went to it because it was an experience. It was people in cat suits that would dance up the aisles, and the big tire flies up into the rafters in the end. There was like a movie approach to it. You know, it was like seeing a movie on a stage. And yet it didn't work when you took the stage and tried to turn it into a movie. And they've been developing that for years and years.
Yeah.
You know, Spielberg owned the rights to it since the beginning. And I think he still gets an executive producer credit on the new one out there, although he probably would wish that he doesn't. And so at one time it was going to be like an animated. It probably should have been a two-dimensional animated cartoon version in the 1990s. With the original score and a reasonable budget, and made for the kids, that would have been its own thing. But to bring, you know, Judi Dench, you know, Idris Elba, Taylor Swift, you know, those guys are
right. I'm seeing all these. I'm going. This is strictly a matter of, well, the check cleared. Yeah, you're going to hate the makeup, but the check. Oh, that's a sweet check. You're going to sleep on a mattress full of $100 bills if you don't already.
Right. And listen, and like I said, nobody knows anything. Maybe somehow it could have worked. I don't think so, but nobody thought Titanic was going to work until it worked. You know, it was going to be the disaster of that year until it wasn't. So it could have
worked. Cats will become a cult classic.
Well, I don't think enough people are going to hate watch it and Rocky Horror it. You know, some people do that with Xanadu. Did you know that?
But oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be the next Xanadu. I think it's going to just die on the vine. And they'll, you know, they'll keep trying to make money from it. It'll stream. It'll this. It'll that.
I keep seeing these breathless stories saying the studio never sends out a second replacement copy.
Right.
I mean, is it really that big a deal?
I think, well, one of the issues was that I think that, you know, once Cats the movie was put into production, they already had the release date. They knew they were going to release it in Christmas of 2019. So everything had to be done to meet that schedule. And I fully believe when the director, Tom Hooper, said, I was editing up to the last minute. You know, we didn't have time to do all the things we wanted to do, because it looks easy to put digital fur and all this stuff. It's not easy at all. Those Toy Story movies, those take years and literally hundreds of millions of dollars in production costs to create those things. They make $1 billion, but they take at least a quarter of a billion to create and oodles of time. But, you know, it's the same reason that Godfather 3 sucked so much. It was it suddenly got green. When it was greenlit, it was then given a release date before there was even a script. And before people sat down to talk about how this thing, what kind of movie was this going to be? So it just failed. And sometimes movies fail. And we can all laugh about the crummy ones, you know. It's very easy and fun to collectively hate on Cats. I never liked it. The Jellicle stuff. But it was never, you know, it wasn't written. T.S. Eliot didn't go, hey, I've got a great idea for a Broadway musical, but for now I'm just going to make them poems. No, they were meant to be poems. And Andrew Lloyd Webber wasn't wrong to say, I'm going to turn this into a Broadway musical. You know, it made him. It made him a billionaire. But it was a wrong idea probably to make it into what it is now. And certainly to we have to now rush it into theaters for December 2019 because that's Oscar season and people are home for the holidays.
Okay, so you're getting fan mail.
From some flounder?
That's
a Rocky and Bullwinkle reference.
I know. I get, yes.
You know that.
I know that.
But all the millennials that I'm sure comprise your audience, I'm not sure they know it. But fan mail, please flatter me, darling.
Rusty just says, I love this guy.
And I love you too, Rusty.
And I walked out on Top Gun. The Russian looked like Darth Vader. I saw it as a hit more for military pilots. I laughed in the theater openly.
Well, it's also
I thought it was a movie about sunglasses.
Almost causes a world war, but at least he gets a girlfriend out of it.
Yeah, I thought it was a movie about sunglasses.
It was very stylish. All I know is suddenly around the WVU campus at that time, there were a lot of guys wearing Ray-Bans and leather jackets.
Right, but the thing is, there's an art to when you're making a point, you take the sunglasses off.
Oh, David Caruso could teach us that one. Yes.
Yeah. Well, see, he's the bastard stepchild of the Top Gun sunglasses thing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. We got to move through these in some
sense. More fan mail, please. More flattery, please.
Ron in Raleigh wants to know if you've ever seen the 1977 Charles Bronson, The White Buffalo.
I've never even heard of that one, and I'm pretty attuned to 1970s Bronson. I don't know that one. I mean, I have Valachi papers and stuff like that I've seen, but not that one. The White Buffalo. It probably has Jill Ireland in it, I bet you, because every one of his movies had Jill Ireland in it. No, I'll have to look up that one.
And
you should follow it up by telling me a little bit about it and what he thinks of it.
There's a decent chance that Ron will do exactly that. Bo, meanwhile, is...
Ron, if you're listening, I have a counter question. Have you ever seen the original Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 with Walter Matthau and Robert Shaw?
That is
the best tough guy gritty 1970s thing ever. It's great. Walter Matthau, action hero. Believe it.
I'd like to see that. And let's see. Darlene wants to know, did you see Ad Astra with Brad Pitt? And if so, what did you think of it? It was my first Pitt movie, as I don't tend towards him in these movies. He's a very good actor, but I found the film dark, brooding, depressing, and there was a disturbing scene with a baboon. Stuff of nightmares, LOL.
Darlene, I haven't seen that one. I'm gonna stream it because, again, it's an original movie based on nothing beforehand, as far as I know. I came around to Brad Pitt, you know, like a lot of people. I think I underestimate him because he was so damn pretty. I mean, he's gorgeous, but he seems to be pretty smart and pretty talented. I forget the name of the writer director of Ad Astra, but I believe I'm not a fan of his movies in general. But I'm willing to give it a chance. I'll stream it. And, but I'm just going to say this. I don't know if you agree or your listeners agree. The movie I fucking hated more than any movie that I actually did drag my ass out to see in a theater was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I fucking hated that movie.
Oh, I had some stirring reviews of that the other night.
I think it's the most misogynist thing. I don't understand why people aren't calling it out enough. I mean, that movie, just every woman in it is either a cipher or they're a bitch. I mean, there's a whole thing.
But if you're Quentin, if you're Quentin Tarantino, don't you get to do that?
See, that's the thing. It's like, oh, it's like let's all worship it. I love Pulp Fiction. I love a lot of his movies. But I love Kill Bill a lot, the first one. But this whole thing of, like, you have to worship a director. You have to every movie that that director makes, you have to love because he's that person. I've never agreed with. I don't love all Hitchcock. And I do think that Quentin Tarantino can be a big friggin' spoiled brat. Ha, ha, ha. You know, I made this. It's a joke. Get it? I get it. And you know what? It's a terrible joke. It's not a funny joke. Brad Pitt killed his wife. And then when you see her in flashbacks, oh, she's a shrewish bitch. She had it coming. Ha, ha, ha. No, 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 thank you. And the whole movie, I didn't even think, you know, aside from the quote unquote political aspects of that, I just thought it wasn't really good filmmaking. I thought it was Quentin Tarantino masturbating for 2.5 hours and asking us to watch. And his recreations of 1960s, 1970s television shows was terrible. It was nothing like what those – you watch any of those things, you know, Have Gun Will Travel or Bonanza. They weren't at all like he represented him in his movie. And I know, oh, well, but then again, and the whole thing of the Manson family, the alternate ending of the Manson tragedy. I know he did the same thing in Inglourious Basterds. I let that one go because it's Nazis and it's fun to do that. But the man, you know, Sharon Tate still has surviving family members and people who remember her lovingly. And she, first of all, she deserved to have her own movie about her and give her some actual dialogue and motivation. And it's not respectful in the least, in my opinion, to say, hey, wouldn't it be funny if we didn't have her die and instead this other stuff, and we get to watch Brad Pitt and Leo take two women in the Manson cult and bash their heads against a wall repeatedly and watch those women crawl and suffer. And yeah, they're Manson people, so it's okay. I hated the whole thing from beginning to end.
Wow. It's not very often that you deliver a full-throated Jeremy ad against a piece of film or TV.
Yeah.
You're usually kind of forgiving, and you say, hey, you know, but it's film, and, you know.
Right. I don't know. Again, I don't want to be like this liberal snowflake thing, but it's not that I think that you should never.
Oh, don't worry. Don't worry. The Canadians and the right wings have you, right wingers in America have you covered, because they're having a conniption because the CDC cut out the Donald Trump cameo from Home Alone 2 so they could put another ad in there.
Right.
But
a real Republican would support, because, hey, that's money.
Right. But the maggots, you know, but the maggots are having a snowflake butt hurt.
I know. But yeah, anyway, I hated that. I hated Home Alone 2, but not as vociferously as I do Once Upon a Time in America. And I know I have a lot of friends who are film nerds like myself, and, you know, women who don't have my point of view. I respect that, but I just didn't really want to see such a hatred toward women played as a joke. And I did want to see Sharon Tate be portrayed not as eye candy, an idealized pixie, but instead as a human being. I think that's
with agency and executive functions and all
capable.
Of that. Okay, well, let's march through. Oh, by the way, thanks going out to Rusty.
Thank you, Rusty, for helping
knock down the fundraising goal this evening. That's huge. We're down.
Oh,
to
wow,
five,
yeah, that is huge.
We're down to 550 now to finish the year and the month. Ralphs wants to know if you've heard anything about The Witcher.
I've heard about it. I haven't watched any of it yet. It seems to be getting good reviews, and there seems to be very sexy people on it. That much I know. And I have nothing wrong with sexy people. Sometimes that's what you need is a good sexy thriller. Fun thing. I don't know anything about it, and I don't mean to sound like I'm making fun of it by using the word sexy. I love sexy. Sexy's okay. Sexist, bad. Sexy, good.
Meanwhile, with regard
no,
to...
No, haven't seen it. Sorry.
No, this explains why you haven't seen White Buffalo. Now I've got to see it. Ron...
You know, maybe, hey, how much money are you trying to raise?
Oh, we got $550 to finish off the year. That, you know.
Okay, here's a challenge to your listeners that I just made up on the spot, and I may regret it, but I'll do it. If the first five listeners to pledge $20 a piece, pledge it and give me a movie challenge. Try to find something that maybe you love. We'll figure it out, but maybe something I haven't seen that you Ooh. Love, and I'll watch it, and maybe you and I, like, through something or other, through Facebook, we'll talk about it. I'll give you, 20 minutes of my time after I've seen it to watch it. Like, let's sort of do like a little movie.
So you're willing to watch five movies?
I'm willing to watch five movies that I may or may not like and talk about them.
In the format of
your listener's choice.
Right, but let me be clear with the community. Don't be a dick.
Okay.
Don't deliberately troll Dan on this.
No, but if you want me to watch a bad movie, I'll watch a bad movie. I don't care.
Now,
porn. Let's say no porn.
No porn.
Okay.
No porn. Foreign films are okay.
Oh, I love foreign films. And listen, you want to give me Mandingo? Go ahead, give me Mandingo. I'll watch Mandingo.
You've never seen Mandingo?
We'll talk about how friggin' racist it is. I'm sure it is.
You've never seen Mandingo?
No.
Okay. Here's Ron and Raleigh says I did see Pelham with Walter Matthau, also the Denzel remake. And here's the White Buffalo stars Charles Bronson as end-of-life Wild Bill Hickok, who meets up with Crazy Horse on a quest to find a white buffalo.
Oh, my God. That would be a really interesting double feature with the Paul Newman, Robert Altman movie, which was called Crazy Horse's Last Stand. Buffalo Bill and the Indians, or Crazy Horse's Last Stand, which starred as this guy probably knows, Paul Newman as Buffalo Bill. So that would be a great double feature. But yeah, I tell you what, did he already give money?
No.
But give $20 to Bob. What's this guy's name? I'm blanking.
This is Ron in Raleigh.
Ron, pledge $20 to Bob before the show's done. The show's done pretty soon. Pledge $20 to Bob and let me know about it. I'll watch it. And Bob will help me get a hold of you, and either on the phone or through text or through IM, we'll talk about it a little bit. And
okay. Well, we have our first successful pledge. Our buddy Deacon Asa wants you to watch a film called The Hebrew Hammer.
Oh, is that with Sacha Baron Cohen? I got to start making notes.
He says, because I haven't been able to convince Bob to watch it in damn near 10 years.
Well, I will watch The Hebrew Hammer. I gotta put this on a list here. So give me a second. So there's the – Rob has not pledged for White Buffalo just yet. Hebrew Hammer. Okay. Now,
and because it's self-defeating if I do the contribution, I'm hoping somebody – somebody who shares my love of the film will chip in $20 so that you will finally sit down and watch Galaxy Quest.
Oh, that would be marvelous. I'd love to watch Galaxy Quest anyway, but I refuse to do it now until somebody gives Bob money. How's that?
Okay.
And then, Rob, since you're pledging the money,
Ron,
I guess, Ron.
No. Asa is pledging.
Asa's pledging for Hebrew Hammer?
Right.
Okay, Asa. I'm guessing that when one pledges to this show, that one would include means of contact, like an email address. Is that how it's done, Bob, or how's that usually done?
Well, I mean, are you offering to interact?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Let me have either a
Yeah, I think you're already friends on Facebook.
Oh, with Asa?
Yeah.
I'll check, and then, but if I'm not, I just want to make sure that we can get a hold of one
another. Asa will friend you. And
friend me, Asa. Daniel Fisher, I think, or is it Dan Fisher? I can't remember.
And Hebrew Hammer is Adam Goldberg.
Adam Goldberg. I love that guy ever since Dazed and Confused, so yes. I'll definitely watch
and
that.
And so there's also the overnight crew, the podcast crew. So you may get more assignments as time goes by. Unfortunately, I have to I have to wrap this up now. Usually,
yeah, I know. I came upon this inspiration a little late in the show. I'm sorry about that.
Well, you and I usually
Dan Fisher on Facebook, by the way. And my profile photo has been the same for about 8 years now, where it's just this yellow circle with my silhouette portrait of myself.
Very good.
So that's the one. Well, I'm friends with Bob, so it's pretty easy. If you're a friend with Bob, look up Bob's friends, Dan Fisher, and there I'll be. And then, yeah. And listen, if you pledge after this thing's done with, just let me know. And
or let me know, and I'll let Dan know, because, you know, Dan answers my mail and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
We're buddies.
I just want to make sure you get your money. I want to make sure you get at least $100 out of this.
Oh, I have a feeling I will. I do. Well, there's too many film buffs out there who would like to play Stump Dan, but I gotta be out of here.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Oh, no worries. And you're an hour ahead of having to take your meds, so I don't know what you're gonna do with this whole hour.
I'm gonna see if my wife wants to do something fun with me. I don't know what.
Yeah, it's like that one wonderful throwaway line in It's a Wonderful Life, where Bert and Ernie, the cop and the taxi driver. I always love that. That's where Bert and Ernie came from.
That's what they say.
And the Violet Bix walks past.
The great Gloria Graham, yes.
And one looks at the other and says, "Think I'll go home and see what the wife's up to."
Yeah. Well, what the wife's up to.
Dan, have yourself a happy new year, and hopefully we will have a January conversation.
Yeah, I hope to. You know, this job has been very, you know, time consuming for me, so I haven't been around a while. I'm sorry about that, but this is as fun. I probably should have come on at 5 today. We have so much more to talk about, but till next time.
All right, take care, Dan.
Merry Christmas, Bedford Falls!
I keep stepping on you when you do that. I'm going to shut up. Do that again. One more time.
Merry Christmas, you old savings and loan. And a happy new year to you in jail.
God, that's good. Dan Fisher, happy new year.
Good night, Cleveland. We love you.
There's nothing like a conversation with Dan Fisher. There just isn't. And so we find ourselves at the end of the program. Thank you, all of you, for joining in. Thanks to all of you who keep the program going, however you so choose to do. Thank you for being subscribers, a la carte, what have you. Now we've got the movie challenge. That's just a delightful idea. Thank you to all of you who just share your precious finite time engaging in the program. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you, Sparky. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa. Thank you, John Fox. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. 20 years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.